Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Kunai Podcast number 23, The Horror of Fang Rock. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Jim. It's Horror of Fang Rock, not The Horror of Fang Rock.
There's an O there in it.
No.
Sure.
You can put an extra one in if you like some people do.
Okay, The Horror of the Fang Rock. So, want to give us a bit of context on The Horror of the Fang Rock there?
Sure, I will do. It's from season 15. It's, of course, Tom Baker and Louise Jameson as Leela. Broadcast between the 3rd and 24th of September 1977. It's the first story from the Graham Williams era as producer, although it's actually the second story that was filmed that season. Invisible Enemy, that was the second story of the season, was actually recorded first.
Yes, in fact, Terence Dix had written out K-9 in this story, hadn't he?
Mm.
Because it was supposed to have come after K-9 had been introduced. But, of course, in the end, he didn't need to write him out. Because he hadn't been written in yet.
Ah, yes, good point. Mm. The script editor is still Bob Holmes, who's there for sort of half the season, isn't he? Mm. Of course, this one was written by Terence Dix. The director for this one is Paddy Russell. The story was a last-minute replacement for Terence Dick's vampire story, which was dropped. It later became, of course, State of Decay.
Yeah, the reason this story had to be dropped was the rest of the BBC weren't that pleased with the Doctor Who doing a vampire story because they were just about to release their version of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Mm.
And they didn't want the two to clash, basically.
Yeah, I'm sure the Doctor Who version would have been much better.
Yes, much closer to the original, I think.
And a few working titles: The Rocks of Doom, The Monster of Fang Rock, and The Beast of Fang Rock. I think the one that ends up with is the best, actually.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
By quite a way. Is there anything else to say, context-wise?
Well, it's one unusual thing, isn't there? That's the studio stuff. There's a little bit Ealing, as usual. I've used the big kind of soundstage there. But the stuff that would have normally been filmed at BBC Television Centre wasn't, because there was engineering work taking place there. So this was filmed at the Pebble Mill Studios in Birmingham, which I believe is the one and only time that was done, Doctor Who. And apparently the Birmingham staff really came up trumps on it. They really worked hard and all the rest of it, because even at this stage, Doctor Who was becoming a little bit a joke behind the scenes and nobody really wanted to work on it. And people, the staff are taking it a little bit for granted, not really putting their 100% in. But because this story was moved to Birmingham, this was their first crack at it, really, and they really went for it.
Mm.
As you'll see from the rest of the season, it does appear that people aren't really taking much effort at the BBC Television Centre.
Yeah, but this one does look really good, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah. It's worth probably just saying at this stage, what is the rest of the season? As we said, The Invisible Enemy comes up next. Then we're on to Image of the Fendal and the Sunmakers, and then Underworld and Invasion of Time, and that's where Series 15 ends, which is a fairly steady decline, I think, from Horror of Fang Rock downwards.
Yeah.
Up to Sunmakers, I think. Image of the Fendal's pretty good.
Yeah.
Underworld and Invasion, I think, is where the rot starts to set in.
Yeah, no arguments from me there. Okay, so we crack on with the story?
Hmm. Okay, so we open with a model shot of a landscape with a lighthouse on it and some fairly dramatic sort of dusk-type sky behind, isn't there? I think it looks really good until the a kind of shooting star effect, which is a fairly sort of clumsy purple blob flying through the air, hitting the sea, and then turning it a rather unconvincing purple. But I think the model work is actually very good. It's the kind of visual effect on top of it, which doesn't work very well.
Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah, the model work is good, and the ship in the sky is dreadful. So then we then see a couple of figures up at the top of the lighthouse, and they're standing on the lamproom gallery outside, aren't they? One of them is a young, clean-shaven chap called Vince. No. The other one's an old, whiskery, rotund chap called Reuben.
A salty old crust of a man.
Yeah. Vince has spotted this light in the sky through a telescope, hasn't he? And he calls to Reuben, but the time Reuben comes out, it's gone. I think it might have been a meteor. And then a third person arrives. This is Ben. He's kind of a middle-aged man. He's got a handlebar moustache, hasn't he?
Mm.
he kind of pokes fun at Vince, doesn't he, saying that, you know, don't worry about it, it's no threat to navigation, it's got nothing to do with us. And then Reuben and Ben head down to go and get their supper.
Yeah, we've got a good idea of what kind of era it is, isn't it? It's sort of late Victorian, early Edwardian. I think we find out later it's early Edwardian, isn't it? As I mentioned, the king. And so there's a lot of mutton chops and big face furniture going on here. Interestingly, Vince is treated as a very young lad, isn't he, throughout this? You know, he's a real kind of whippersnapper. He's played by John Abbott, who was 32 when this was recorded.
Yeah.
So probably not that much younger than Ralph Watson, who plays Ben, who also played Captain Knight in The Web of Fear and Ettis in The Monster of Peladon. But of course he had a dead badger strapped to his head for that.
Yeah, he was also in The Underwater Menace, but we won't go into that.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, and they're all kind of talking in kind of yokel accents as well, aren't they?
Yeah, it turns out it's Hampshire, doesn't it? Probably somewhere about then, because people have lost their way from Brighton, as we find out later on, come further down the coast. But it's generic local yokel, isn't it? Which is the default for anyone
outside of London.
Yeah, who doesn't speak received pronunciation in Doctor Who at this stage is a West Country yokel.
Yeah. The next thing you see is a point of view shot from something down on the rocks, looking up at the lighthouse. And this is quite effective, I think. It's obviously it's kind of an eye shaped, isn't it? And it's got a green tinge around the edges.
Yeah, it's very reminiscent of the Wirren's eye view we get in the Ark in Space, isn't it?
Mm.
We also get there's a little bit of kind of sound effect. I don't know if it's Dick Mills or Dudley Simpson, but there's a little kind of wobbly sound, isn't there, every time you look through the eye of the alien.
Yes, there is.
It's all quite effective. So you see this alien looking at the lighthouse and sort of bobbing about in the sea, don't you? It's quite good. The backdrop for the lamp room at the very top of the lighthouse is variably good, I think. This first shot, it looks excellent, I think, because they've got this kind of dusk in the background.
Yeah.
Later on, it's not quite as good, and then when there's a fog comes up later on, and the fog doesn't really look that effective. The only problem with the CSO is when the camera moves, it moves unnaturally, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's difficult to describe without looking at it, I think, but it doesn't move as an eye would, you know, as it would if it was going on outside and your eye was moving about. It doesn't work with the camera because it's just, you know, it's obviously green screen or blue screen, I think, back then, behind, and that doesn't work, which is a bit of a shame. I think they might even have been better having sort of curtains around and a smoke machine or something, because it doesn't look very effective later on. At this stage, it does look good.
Yeah, that's true. But I still think it's not terrible. It's you know, the effects throughout I think are reasonably good, with one or two exceptions.
But yeah,
it's the opening shot, and well, we'll come to the rest.
We will in time. So yeah, we end up in the crew room, don't we? Next, which is, you know, where they've got the sort of food making stuff and a table. Interestingly, it's for quite a small number of sets, aren't they, for this one, as you'd expect in a lighthouse. There's only a few rooms, and it all adds to the kind of claustrophobia. It works well. Ben and Reuben are arguing about the merits of oil and electric lamps for lighthouses. Of course, Reuben likes the old oil ones, and Ben likes the new electricity. And this carries on for quite a lot of episode one, doesn't it? They kind of keep making sort of remarks at the expense of the other about whichever medium they're supporting. And then we get a call on the, what do you call these things, these blower things?
Speaking tube. Like,
speaking tube, yes. You get Vince calls down on the speaking tube, and we kind of hear, we don't hear what Reuben says because we're back up in the lamp room with Vince, but Reuben jokes that he's King Edward. So that's how we can place roughly where it is. And Vince is just warning that a fog has suddenly developed out of nowhere.
Yeah, Ben goes up to see for himself because there was absolutely no sign of this fog earlier, so he's concerned about it. Then we see the TARDIS arriving nearby on the rocks down below. It's a model shot, isn't it? It looks a bit like a model as well. It's okay, but it's a bit obviously a model.
Yeah, again, the main problem of this is other than it looking like a model, do you remember back in The Spearhead from Space?
I have trouble now seeing the lamp, the light from the lighthouse. So they need to get the siren going. They're still going on about oil. Reuben says to Ben that oil's got a better light in fog. But Ben says that electricity is just as good and more reliable. And just as he says that, the light goes out.
Yes, much to Reuben's amusement. Yes, and it's quite a good line from Ben, isn't it? About you're lucky to see the light within the lighthouse, let alone outside with an oil lamp. Yeah, it's quite funny. So then we go back to where the TARDIS has landed, and the Doctor's clearly planned to take Leela to Brighton. This is hot on the heels of Talons of Weng Chiang, the mighty Talons of Weng Chiang, which is obviously in the Victorian era. So they come forward a few years to take Leela to Brighton. Obviously, they haven't quite managed it. I think I mentioned earlier, some of this is filmed at Ealing Studios, and these are the scenes around the kind of rocks around the lighthouse where the TARDIS has landed. It's a rather feeble bit here, isn't it? The Doctor comes out with a lengthy explanation of why the TARDIS has landed where it has, and the explanation boils down to it got lost in the fog, which is quite pathetic, isn't it, for this hyper advanced time space machine.
Oh no, I thought that was quite a funny line. There's a better one earlier where Leela says, "This isn't Brighton," is it? He says, so he doesn't think so. It's not even Hove. Could be Worthing.
Yes.
So that was good. And but then he's yeah, the line he actually says is, "The localized condition of planetary atmospheric condensation caused a malfunction in the visionary orientation circuits." Or to put it another way, we got lost in the fog. Oh, that's
Yeah.
great though.
It's a funny line, but it's a bit pathetic the TARDIS can't cope with it. Mind you, if it has a busted spring and a fast return switch that plunges its occupants into the sun, then who knows what else it gets wrong. But he also notices the lighthouse isn't working properly either, and as it turns out, it's the same cause. So we get back in the lighthouse, Ben is down in the sort of generator stroke boiler room, examining the machinery. As he's doing so, he hasn't done anything to it, but the lights suddenly come back on again. And up in the lamp room, Vince is sort of pleased and says, "Good old Ben." But Reuben is still grumbling about electricery, or words to that effect.
As he heads up the stairs, as Ben heads up the stairs, the outer door of the lighthouse swings open, and there's this kind of green glow, and the sound of kind of static. Something's arrived.
Nastiness.
Vince is upstairs putting on a kind of a heavy jersey, isn't he? Against the cold, I guess. And Ben comes in saying that it's even colder downstairs in the generator room. And he tells him that he didn't actually fix anything, he did it of his own accord. The Doctor and Leela, meanwhile, are clambering over the rocks down below. They see the lighthouse light has now come on, and they hear the foghorn as well, don't they? The Doctor wants to check where they are by going to the lighthouse. As they wander off, Leela senses that something's up.
It's funny, isn't it? The Doctor says, "Ask for directions," like that's going to help with the TARDIS. But that's the excuse he has for going to the lighthouse. Leela's a great companion, I think. And one of the things I like about her is that she kind of senses when things are wrong, and she's also sort of frightened by things that she doesn't understand. Although she's a very brave person, isn't she? She's very wary as well. So she hears a foghorn and she thinks it's, oh, it's a mighty beast or something. She's really good fun.
There's a good interplay between them, isn't there? Where she gets the wrong end of the stick about quite a few things, and
Yeah, she's very.
she plays the naive savage very well, I think.
She does, and she's very well written for in this story, which isn't always the case, unfortunately. But
No.
Terence Stitch does a good job with it, or Bob Holmes, whoever is handling her dialogue, anyway. So the lights go off again, and Ben hurries down the stairs to investigate. He opens the coal hole door, doesn't he? When they get the coal out to stoke the boiler. And then we get the alien point of view shot again, with Ben in its sights, and it sort of bears down on Ben, and he screams. His scream is drowned out by Vince sounding the foghorn, though, which is a classic old movie type trick, isn't it?
Yeah, horror
So,
movie thing, yeah.
yeah, Vince and Reuben are wondering about the sudden fog. Reuben's been at this job for years, hasn't he? And he didn't see any sign of it, so. Something weird is happening. So Vince goes down to help Ben, while Reuben stands on his own, saying, "Tain't natural."
The Doctor and Leela arrive at the generator room. They come inside, and they Leela, she's I can't remember what the Doctor says to her, but she says she's not a technician, doesn't she? Obviously, a reference back to her opening story, Face of Evil.
Yeah, because they're the two tribes, and the Sever team and the Tesh, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Tesh descended from the technicians, and the Sever team descending from the Survey team.
Mm.
So, yeah, and the Doctor queries her after, right at the end of the scene, doesn't he? Technician. But he's, rather than just diving in and trying to fix the problem, he decides to be polite to talk to the crew about it first, so that they head upstairs. And they bump into Vince on the stairs. And the Doctor tells them that they are mislaid mariners, as if someone else has mislaid them, which I suppose they have, because you count the TARDIS. But, Vince seems to accept this, doesn't he? Because of the fog, he just thinks, well, all right, you were sailing past, you got lost in the fog, and here you are, sort of thing. So no real questions asked.
Mm.
He takes him to the crew room to sort out some victuals for them. He asks if theirs is a small craft. The Doctor says yes, and the Leela says no simultaneously.
Yeah.
And small in some ways, and the other says big in others. So, yeah, nicely done, I think, for the two actors.
Yeah, definitely. Vince tells them they've been having trouble with the power, and that there's just the three of them, you know, in the lighthouse. Doctor somehow finds a bowler hat from somewhere, doesn't he? Puts it on. I'm quite sure, yeah. You know, where he found that. But he pops it on his head and he has it on for a few scenes.
Yeah, it's quite an iconic picture for Fang Rock, isn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of the publicity stuff's got him wearing the bowler. He doesn't at any point say bowler hats are cool, though, does he?
No, he doesn't. No, he asks about Ben, why he's not down in the generator room. Vince says, well, he is. Yeah, you must have seen him. And he says, oh, well, maybe he popped out for a bit and they just missed him in the fog. Leela says, well, she'd have heard him if he was there. So the Doctor offers to go and have a look for him. You know, maybe he'll be able to help because he knows a bit about these types of things. He asks Vince to look after the young lady, leaving Leela with him.
Actually, there's a little line I just wanted to mention before this. Vince is kind of joking about Ruben's fairly Luddite attitude towards electricity. And Doctor kind of says he knows the type. You know, in the early days of oil, he would have said there's nothing like a really large candle.
Yeah, good.
A great line. So, yeah, Leela's left with Vince. Vince is sort of talking about how lonely he gets on the island, which is slightly worryingly like Vasor in Keys of Mariners, isn't it?
Trapped
in his hut with Barbara, but he's completely innocent and all that.
Yeah.
But she scolds him for that and says he shouldn't be talking to animals, he should be talking to the elders of his tribe. And she then says she needs some dry clothes. He says they haven't got anything suitable for a lady. And she says, I'm no lady, Vince, and starts to undress. And Vince sort of covers his eyes and runs off in panic.
He does.
Yeah, lovely scene, that.
Yeah, it's really funny. The Doctor gets down to the power room and he opens the door and calls out into the fog for Ben. And he's having a look around and he kind of stops, doesn't he? And he's obviously looking at something when Vince arrives. Vince sort of says to him, oh, you found the trouble then? And the Doctor says, yes, I always find trouble, which is excellent.
Yeah, that's a great line.
Really well delivered. And, of course, Ben's on the floor, dead, behind the generator. Leela arrives as well, and she's now wearing one of Vince's woolly jumpers.
Vince and trousers for a lady in Edwardian era.
Yeah, yeah. And Vince goes over and has a look at Ben, and he's very upset, isn't he? The Doctor says he died of a massive electric shock. He'd have died instantly. And he asks Vince to go and tell Reuben. And so he heads upstairs.
But the Doctor actually goes straight to the coal hole, doesn't he? But only finds a shovel in there. The Doctor believes whatever it is, he already thinks, you know, that some sort of agent has caused Ben's death. Whatever it is, it has the ability to drain electricity. And then he finds a highly mangled oil lamp, doesn't he?
Mm.
Leela's wondering whether it's a sea creature, which turns out to be not a million miles from the truth, but not in the way that she thinks, I think. But this oil lamp is absolutely trashed, isn't it?
Yeah.
By the alien.
That's right. Yeah, so up at the top of the, up in the lamp room, Reuben is crossing himself, isn't he, as Vince has told him about Ben. He's sort of saying that it doesn't make any sense. Ben knew every inch of the machine. How could it have killed him? Reuben's asking about the Doctor and Leela. He wonders if they're foreigners. He thinks they might be spies. He says, frogs, Ruskies, Germans. Maybe they did for Ben, sort of thing. And he goes off to take a look at them. Just before he goes, though, Vince asks him about contacting the mainland to take Ben's body away. Reuben says he'll do it when he gets light. But he also says that Ben's body won't rest easy, doesn't he? Which puts the willies up Vince even more, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's actually quite kind to Vincey saying, "Oh, don't worry about all the arrangements. I'll do all that." Yeah, they do treat him a little bit with kid gloves, don't they? Because he's so young at 32 years old. But he won't rest easy. There'll be anger in his soul.
Yeah,
which it has the opposite effect to making Vince feel better. So back in the crew room, the doctor's playing with the Marconi wireless telegraph while Leela's eating something. Reuben arrives and he's highly suspicious, thinking they might be spies. He tells the doctor to get off the wireless telegraph immediately.
Mm.
The doctor wonders why Reuben isn't using the telegraph to report Ben's death to the mainland. And Reuben just sardonically says, well, that's not going to bring Ben back, is it? He'll use the semaphore in the morning. Which prompts the doctor to wonder if Reuben can actually use his telegraph or not. Leela, unfortunately, chooses to wipe her mouth on Ben's shroud, doesn't she? which Reuben doesn't take kindly to and starts making remarks about, how they treat the dead in his country. Yeah, he really does think they're foreign.
Mm. Yeah, and he's been very cold towards them, isn't he? And then eventually the doctor asks if he thinks it was them that killed Ben. He doesn't say yes, but then he doesn't say no either, does he? And he kind of says, I know what I know, kind of thing, doesn't he? The doctor says that they're only trying to help. Reuben says that they'll manage, and he goes off to tend to Ben.
Well, there's that great bit, isn't there, when he says, I know what I know and what I think. And the doctor says, incontrovertible, sarcastically, doesn't he? And then he thinks that's a foreign word, doesn't he? He says, and don't start talking your own lingo to each other. I won't have that.
Yeah.
Great little scene finished by the doctor saying, stubborn old mule.
Yes. Good stuff. Once Reuben's gone, Leela asks if the creature's likely to return. And she wants to go out and hunt it, doesn't she? The doctor's not so keen. And he goes off to talk to Vince. Downstairs, though, Reuben is covering Ben's body with a shroud, and Leela creeps past him and outside with her knife in her hand. So she's obviously taking matters into her own hands, going out to see if she can find this creature herself.
A one-woman vigilante. Stalking the rocks of Fang Rock.
Yes.
So up in the lab room, Vince tells the doctor about the fireball that he saw and how it landed in the sea nearby. And then there was a sudden fog and cold. And, the doctor's interested in this information and says, you're a good lad, Vince. Which is nice of him. And then we're out on the rocks with Leela. And very effective, I think, considering these are in Ealing Studios. Mm. I thought this was on location somewhere, but apparently not. Yeah, it's very foggy and, the set looks good and the rock pools look effective, don't they?
Yeah, I think so.
As she has a look around, she finds one of these rock pools with a load of dead fish all belly up floating about. So something's got them.
Yeah. And you hear the static noise again, don't you? So the creature is obviously close by.
Yeah.
The doctor's telling Vince that on Pharos they had slaves to keep the bonfires going. Reference to the Pharos Lighthouse, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world.
Vince obviously doesn't realise that he's talking about the past, does he?
No.
He says, I didn't realise they still used slaves.
Yes. But Reuben comes in and he tells Vince to get his supper, that he's stoked the boiler himself and he's made Ben decent. And as Vince heads down the stairs, you hear the static again, don't you? Which is a bit strange, because you've heard it near Leela outside, and then you hear it again in the lighthouse. I'm not quite sure what the noise is. I just thought it was a noise that the creature made as it was moving along, but it gives the impression it's in two places at once.
Maybe it can do what it's doing remotely, but I think the lights are still on at this point, aren't they? So it isn't draining the power too much at that point, is it?
No.
So, yeah, it's just a general air of unease, isn't it?
Yeah.
The doctor winks at Reuben, doesn't he, at the end of the scene? He's really deliberately winding him up.
Yes.
Vince, on his way down, hears that noise, doesn't he?
Hmm.
And wonders if Ben's up and about, which is an odd thing to think, isn't it? As a first conclusion to draw.
It is, but, he's obviously been frightened by the stories that Reuben's been telling him, isn't he? So,
he's not resting easy.
Yeah, he's very jumpy at this point, isn't he? So, then we're back with Leela outside, and we get the point of view from the creature and it's watching her, isn't it? Which, yeah, I mean, that's what I mean, because it's outside at this point, watching Leo.
Yeah.
So what's the noise of static in the lighthouse?
Maybe, well, there's a little bit of residual electricity, isn't there, later on we see. Maybe it's something to do with that.
So Vince goes down to the boiler room and he finds that Ben's body's gone.
Mm.
And he frantically uses the speaking tube to tell Reuben. He tells him that Ben's walking. At this point, Lena comes back in from outside. And then all hell breaks loose, basically, doesn't it?
Mm. The doctor tells Reuben there's a light outside, and they go to investigate. Reuben uses a speaking tube to call Vince and tells him there's a ship off the rocks about to strike. So Vince and Leela race up the stairs. It turns out it's a steam yacht that is travelling far too fast, you know, for the area and you know, the weather conditions. Vince arrives in the lamp room, and Reuben gets him to take over the foghorn, while Reuben goes and shoots off a flare. You then get a shot of the ship sort of heading towards camera, and you can hear an argument on there, can't you?
Yeah, you can hear shouting and... Yeah,
yeah, there's a couple of... Two or three blokes shouting and a woman sort of screaming, or at least sort of talking quite frantically.
Hysterically, maybe?
Yes, she gets more hysterical later, doesn't she? But she's hysterical throughout most of it. And then we see a model ship made of matchsticks pushed onto some model rocks, which is a little bit unfortunate. But
yeah. I don't think it's too bad.
Something about the way that it strikes, I think, doesn't work that well. It's done in real time, isn't it?
Mm.
Normally this kind of stuff would be smashed into and then slowed down to make everything seem bigger.
Mm.
If you see what I mean, that's how they do most model work, isn't it? But this one is done in real time, so it's basically pushed against these rocks and just kind of fractures. And then kind of just kind of yaws drastically towards camera, doesn't it? Eventually.
Yeah, and they hold the shot too long, I think.
Yes, they do. They linger a little.
They linger on it too long before the music, because obviously this is right at the end of the episode, before the scene comes in and the music starts. You know, if they'd have cut it a second or two earlier, it would have been much more effective.
Mm. I remember watching this, yeah, as it was first screened as a 9-year-old, and I remember that I thought that looked really good. So, yeah,
easily impressed.
Yeah, I was congenitally stupid.
Still are, mate.
you can't shake that off with their appearance. But it's one of those things, isn't it? You know, maybe his memory plays tricks, isn't it? Because you didn't get a chance to see it again for, you know, several decades. But you know, it worked then, but it just doesn't work now. I think the flares are quite good, but they're not actually flares, obviously, because this whole thing's a little model. But they're two rod-mounted light bulbs, but I think they're quite effective.
Yeah, they work well. Pretty they didn't use one earlier, right at the start, actually.
Oh, yeah, that would have been better than what they did use.
Yeah.
Anyway, end of part one.
Yes, yeah, good opening episode.
Mm, definitely.
Yeah. Apparently the model they used for the ship was reused from the Oneidin line. How would you describe the Oneidin line?
A turn-of-the-century nautical drama, or is it maybe earlier than that? I don't can't remember if it's Victorian or Edwardian, but it was quite a long-running drama series, wasn't it? Of a nautical bent, I think it was sort of merchant. Which, incidentally, I had been going through life thinking that Colin Douglas, who plays Reuben, was the main sort of salty old crust in the old Oneidin line. It wasn't, actually.
Okay. Do you know who it wasn't?
I looked it up. I've forgotten the name, but it isn't Colin Douglas. That's all I know.
You're useless, man. What's the point of looking something up if you don't remember it? Exactly.
It's fun.
it's fun.
Not instantly. But I instantly forget it, so...
Yeah, a fleeting moment of fun for you. Well done.
Yes, seconds of fun for all the family.
Anyway, we're into part two now. They realise the ship's hit the rocks. Leela's very quick to say, oh, well, they'll all die then, won't they?
She literally turns her back on the wreckage and says, they will all die then. Which is great. Leela's attitude to death is brilliant, isn't it?
It is.
She's very matter-of-fact about it.
Mm. But Reuben thinks that if there's any survivors, they'll be washed ashore. So he, the doctor, and Vince will head down to go and see if there's anybody been washed up, leaving Leela behind to play with the foghorn. She's yes. Hours of fun for Leela there.
Yeah, she enjoys it, doesn't she? She's a bit reluctant at first, but she gets into it. But it's great, isn't it? Reuben says, "Keep that siren going, mister," to the doctor.
Yeah.
And then the doctor just delegates that task to Leela and he follows Reuben. But Leela always gets fed up when she's left behind, doesn't she?
Yeah.
In anything. That's what, just part of her character, really. But as we find out later, she gets quite a lot of rather strange enjoyment about pulling the foghorn lead.
Reuben also tells the doctor to bring rope. Yeah, they're in the generator room at this point, aren't they?
Mm.
And as he goes to pick this rope up, he gets a light shock, doesn't he, from sort of static electricity.
That's what I was wondering about. It's always kind of residual electricity about, isn't it? He gets zapped again later on, doesn't he?
Mm.
I'm wondering if that's what people are hearing, crackling away.
Yeah, it could be. You know, he follows the others out, doesn't he? Upstairs, Luther is surprised when the light just comes back on. And then we're outside. They're all calling out. Reuben's calling, "Ahoy!" And I noticed the light has come back on the lighthouse. Reuben complains again about electricity, doesn't he?
He never misses a moment.
No. And the doctor sort of says, "Yes, it seems to need it." So, you know, he's figured out that the electricity is the key to it. And then Leela, looking a bit glum upstairs, having been left behind, she goes out onto the gallery and she spots this creature crawling along on the rocks below. That's pretty dreadful, actually, isn't it? It's just some sort of green blobby thing being pulled along on a bit of string. And it's, not good.
It isn't good. I think it's interesting that they've tried to get away from the man in the rubber suit alien.
Yeah.
You know, quite bravely, I suppose. But it's not really well realised in any of its forms. There's one slightly more impressive bit later on, I think, but this certainly doesn't work at all well.
No, it's poor.
In fact, when I first watched this, I thought, as a highly intelligent 9-year-old, I remember watching it. I remember thinking, well, that can't be the monster. That must be something to do with it, but not the real monster.
Yeah.
It is the only monster, as it turns out.
Yes, not the best. But you know, we don't see a lot of it, do we? So.
No, it's used sparingly. Certainly at this stage, you know, the first three episodes, it's very sparingly used, isn't it?
Mm.
But back to the busted steam yacht. Three of the people from the yacht are brought up to the crew room. These are Lord Palmerdale, sort of a youngish bloke, I guess, with a big moustache. Colonel Skinsale, is a grey-haired chap. They're all in sort of evening wear, aren't they?
Mm.
Colonel Skinsale is played by Alan Rowe, who has quite a long history with Doctor Who. He's Dr. Evans in the moon base, Patrick Troughton. He was the rather effete Sir Edward in the Time Warrior, as you'll remember from our podcast. And he later appears in Full Circle as one of the deciders, decider Gareth.
Mm.
The third person is Adelaide, who is Lord Palmerdale's secretary stroke fancy woman. So the crew are helping them off with very old-fashioned life jackets, aren't they?
Yeah, they're like old bits of old barrel, aren't they, kind of strapped around them.
Yeah, they're the old things. They just about aid buoyancy, I think, but not much more. Lord Palmerdale continually asks for brandy, doesn't he? And his requests are rebutted regularly. And Vince says, well, you can have some soup, because alcohol's not allowed on the lighthouse. Mm. And then Vince puts all his attention into Adelaide, doesn't he, because she's the lady. And he puts her next to the little sort of fire they have up there in that room. And despite Palmerdale being wet through, because it sounds like he's jumped off the boat, doesn't he, before it landed or something. Anyway, he got wet and the others didn't really. We start getting to this sort of kind of class system, I suppose, don't we, here? Because she asks Vince what his name is. And he says, Hawkins, Vince Hawkins. And she says, thank you, Hawkins.
Yes.
So instantly she's assumed a superiority over Vince.
Exactly. There's also some kind of thing going on between Palmerdale and Skinsale, isn't there?
Yeah, they're constantly taking pot shots at each other, aren't they, throughout the story?
Yeah.
We find out why a little bit later on.
Exactly. Skinsale's poking fun at him for being impatient and jumping overboard.
But yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, he's very impatient to sort out some business, isn't he?
Yes.
More of which later.
Up in the lamp room, Leela is telling the doctor about the creature that she saw down the rocks. He wants her to show him where it was, and he says, don't tell the others yet. He doesn't want to be telling them that you know, there's some alien creature outside, for obvious reasons.
Panic!
Yes. Or, you're completely mad, lock him up.
Yeah, more likely.
Yeah. But Reuben overhears him, doesn't he? And he basically warns him against going after it. He says he thinks it's the beast of Fang Rock. The doctor looks very amused when he says this, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But then Leela is just sort of biting her lip, isn't she? Looking really scared. Oh. I just thought that was excellent.
It's really, really good, isn't it? Yeah. See, the doctor instantly disbelieves it. Leela instantly believes it.
Yeah.
And he turns around to share a smirk with Leela and then sees that she looks really worried.
Yeah.
It's really well played. They're a great partnership, these two, I think.
I think they are. One of the best.
Mm.
Palmerdale's still demanding dry clothes. Vince says he'll attend to him when he's given the lady her soup. Skinsell has another pop at him, doesn't he? Then the doctor bursts in, asking for Harker, the ship's coxswain. He'd stayed down to secure the boat, and the doctor needs him for something. And he just sits down, puts his feet on the desk, and says, "I'll wait."
To the horror of everyone else.
Yeah.
Staring at his feet on the table, particularly Adelaide is disgusted by his behaviour.
She is.
And we find a little bit more, don't we? Just kind of context of what they're saying to each other. It sounds like Palmerdale actually caused the shipwreck. He seemed to be the person he wanted to be going at full speed. Obviously ties in with this brush he's in to do this piece of business. Palmerdale asks the doctor whether he's in charge, and he says, "No, but I'm full of ideas." Brilliant reply.
Yeah. Vince goes off to stoke the boiler. Doctor tells Leela to go with him. Adelaide questions this, you know, why are you sending a girl to do that kind of work? And the doctor sort of tells her about Ben dying earlier and that Vince doesn't like going down there alone.
Yeah, she looks a bit sort of disgusted and horrified, doesn't he, about Ben's electrocution?
Yeah. Skinsale starts up some sort of anecdote about his time in India or something, doesn't he? But he's shut up by an angry Lord Palmerdale. He's obviously heard this many times. They're getting into some kind of argument, and the doctor just stands up and shouts, "Just a moment! We haven't been introduced!" Yeah. And then just probably sits down again. And,
yeah, looking very bored, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it kind of has the effect, doesn't it? Because everyone stops and the introductions are duly made.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That bit by bit you get through the script, you get an idea of who these people are. Because Palmerdale tells Skinsell to stop talking about the army, doesn't he? Mm. And he says that those stories are even more boring than his House of Commons anecdotes. So you know that Skinsell was in the army, is now an MP.
Mm.
And it's without tons of exposition, it's done quite cleverly. I think you work out roughly who everybody is.
Yeah.
Even before these introductions, the doctor calls. It turns out they were travelling from Deauville to Southampton. A special train was then going to take Palmerdale and presumably the others to London to do some urgent business. He needed to get there as soon as the market opens in London. So, yes, he has some urgent business to conduct. The doctor does something similar, doesn't he? Yeah. He says excitedly to Palmerdale, "You want to go to London?" And Palmerdale sort of eagerly says yes. And the doctor says, "You have no chance in this fog," and walks off. Of course, Skinsell thinks this is hilarious, and Palmerdale is absolutely furious.
Mm. Back downstairs in the boiler room, Vince is still stoking the boiler. Leela hears something being dragged over the rocks outside, doesn't she? She tells Vince to go and get the doctor. She picks up a shovel and she's kind of waiting behind the door, which opens, and somebody comes in dragging a body. Leela's about to belt him with this shovel. But the doctor arrives and he stops her, saying that, you know, it's Harker, his friend, and Harker is dragging in Ben's body. He found it in the sea as he was tying the boat up. And by all accounts, it's a pretty hideous sight. You don't see it at all, do you?
But they all kind of some blood, don't you? But that's all you see.
Yeah, it doesn't sound pleasant from their descriptions.
No.
The doctor sends Harker up to the crew room to get some rest, I guess, and then they close the door. Leela asks if it was the beast of Fang Rock that ate Ben. The doctor says there's no such thing. He thinks that the creature's carried out a post-mortem on Ben's body to study the human anatomy, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And then we hear Vince calling, and the doctor and Leela drag Ben's body behind the generator so he won't see it. We know by now he's a fairly fragile individual, isn't he? So the sight of that is not going to go down too well.
He's still talking about Ben, isn't he? And Leela has explained to him that the dead do not walk. And she kind of has him by the shoulders, doesn't she? During this, the doctor is just looking very moodily into the distance, isn't he? Obviously worried about what's going on down there.
Yeah.
Which is good. It's always good, I think, to see the doctor being worried about things. It probably doesn't happen enough, I think, he said.
No.
But back up in the crew room, Palmerdale wants to make for the mainland despite the fog. And like everyone is sort of talking him out of it, or trying to. And then it just comes to Harker just faces him up, doesn't he?
Mm.
Saying, you know, well, I'm the coxswain of the ship and it's not going anywhere in this fog. Palmerdale's furious. You know, Harker's an employee, he should do what he's told, but he just stubbornly refuses. And of course, Skinsale finds this very amusing.
Yeah, he says it's mutiny.
Yeah. Back down in the generator room, the doctor's trying to fob off Vince with a story that Ben was only stunned and he sort of partially recovered and staggered out into the sea and was then drowned. Mm. So just, you know, trying to take the alien intervention out of the whole story. Vince isn't having it, really. Vince is saying, well, you know, Ben was definitely dead. And then the doctor basically has to blind him with science, doesn't he? So he says to Vince, electricity has strange effects, Vince. This is really well played, I think, by John Abbott as Vince, because suddenly Vince feels really kind of small and stupid, doesn't he? Because he doesn't understand electricity at all. So therefore he doesn't understand any of the effects of it. It's really quite a heart-rending moment, isn't it? Vince says, oh, sorry, sir, reckon I made a bit of a fool of myself. And then sort of walks off, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Which is, it feels a little bit cruel, but it's, at the time it's necessary, isn't it? Just to stop Vince flipping out, basically.
Yeah.
And the doctor doesn't really know what the truth is yet anyway. He doesn't want to cede any terrifying alien menaces to Vince in his current mood. You know, he's shocked enough with Ben's death. But really nice to play scene, I think.
Yeah, that's excellent. Upstairs in the crew room, Lord Palmerdale is trying to convince the others that it was the inefficiency of the lighthouse team that caused the ship to crash.
Yeah, nice try.
Yeah, the others aren't having any of it, though, are they? No. They're saying actually it was his fault. They were going too fast. He says there'll be an inquiry, at which point the doctor enters saying that the inquiry has already begun. Mm-hmm. He tells them all to stay put and disappears again, doesn't he? And they wonder about his sanity. It's amazing the number of times people wonder about the doctor's sanity, isn't it?
Well, you would, wouldn't you? Particularly the Tom Baker's doctor.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder about Tom Baker's sanity.
I don't wonder about it anymore, no.
He hasn't got any sanity.
Adelaide thinks the girl's a bit peculiar too, but Skinsale says he thought she was quite a looker.
We forgot to mention, actually, didn't we? The first time Leela appears in the crew room, Skinsale looks very interested, doesn't he? I say. He almost says ding-dong, but not quite.
Not quite, no. Yeah, he says oh, he thinks she was quite a looker. Adelaide says, oh, she was positively grotesque. She goes, were you a long time in India, Colonel?
Long enough to appreciate nature.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great scene, isn't it? Skinsale's actually quite impressed with the doctor, isn't it?
Mm.
And his air of authority, and clearly, for other reasons, impressed by Leela. But Adelaide is quite a bit of a pain in the backside, isn't she?
Yeah.
Throughout. She's very well cast, isn't she, actually? Because when she first arrives, she looks kind of, you know, quite sweet, and, you know, quite nice to look at. But then you look at her carefully, she's got a really hard face, isn't she?
Mm.
A really nice piece of casting, because, you know, clearly that is what her character's like. Anyway, she demands a private sleeping area. So Skinsale gets on the blower to Reuben, who tells him there's bunks in the sleeping quarters. And then Reuben and Vince spot the Doctor and Leela out on the rocks, and they're trying to search for the alien. And Reuben starts talking about the Beast of Fangrock to Vince. Vince first kind of scoffs at that. It turns out it's in the 20s, which must be the 1820s at this point.
Mm.
So you know, quite a long time ago, probably 80-odd years ago. But Vince initially kind of scoffs at this. And as Reuben carries on, Vince is visibly kind of drawn into the story, isn't he? Which doesn't help us, you know, Dr. Leela have been trying their best to take anything alien or supernatural out of the equation for Vince, but Reuben's doing the opposite.
Yeah, out on the rocks, the Doctor and Leela, the Doctor's got a compass in his hand, which is just kind of spinning around, and it, you know, shows that there's a strong electrical field present. The Doctor thinks it's strong enough to kill a man. and it probably explains the phosphorescent glow that Leela saw on the creature. She shows him the dead fish in the pool. She asks, what is this creature? He says he still doesn't know, but he does know that it's desperate and it's cunning. And they start to head back. And as they leave, we see the green glow again and hear the static noise.
Yeah, the creature is close at hand, isn't it?
Mm.
So back in the lighthouse, Skinsell has put Adelaide to bed in the sort of bunk room. And he and Palmdale start talking. You kind of get the gossip, don't you, of what they're up to. Skinsell, as we know, is now in politics, and he appears to have given Palmdale some inside information in return for Palmdale letting him off some debt that he seemed to have accrued.
Mm.
Palmdale is desperate to use this information, but he can't because he can't get to London in time to do anything with it. So, as he can't do anything with the information, it's no good to him. So he threatens to expose Skinsell. Skinsell isn't worried, though, is he? Oh, he says he isn't worried. He appears to be quite worried later. He says to Palmdale he's not worried. He says that he, Skinsell, is an officer and a gentleman, but Palmdale is a nobody, just about a money grubber, basically, despite his title. So basically, so it's his word against him. Palmdale tries to besmirch Skinsell's name, then Skinsell will sue Palmdale for every penny he's got. So although they appear sort of to be friends, don't they? Although they've been having a pop at each other, they really are enemies more than anything else, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
Which is it's another nice dynamic, isn't it, to add to this whole story?
Yeah, it's a nice kind of subplot to beef it up a bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Doctor and Leela return to the boiler room. The Doctor thinks that the creature is going to return. It was taking away Ben's body for examination when Leela saw it, probably to its spaceship, which is under the sea. Leela gets the wrong end of the stick here, doesn't she? She thinks it might be another TARDIS. The Doctor says no. He reiterates again that he thinks it's after electricity, and it's got kind of a furtive behaviour pattern, he says. He thinks that the fog has been caused by the creature as well, hasn't he? And that it's now probably ready to get bolder and that they're in terrible danger. And that's quite funny because when he says that, Leela says, oh, don't be afraid, Doctor. She wants to post guards, but again, the Doctor says they can't tell the others that they'll never be believed. And then he says, what do you mean, don't be afraid?
Yeah, he doesn't take that. It's normally the other way around. He's normally telling companions not to be afraid.
Yeah.
But Leela's a very different kind of companion.
Yes. But sometimes, though, she says things and you think, does she really mean it? But and then she'll just laugh or smile afterwards, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's got a sense of humour, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Which we see actually two or three times in this story.
Mm.
And she's not averse to slightly winding the Doctor up.
Yes.
This kind of remark, but some of it's done in all innocence as well, isn't she? Because she's that kind of person. She,
mm.
But it's all good stuff. So back up in the crew room, Lord Palmerdale is furtively writing a note. He clearly doesn't want Skinsell to see it, does he? He keeps his eye on Skinsell throughout. And he goes over and wakes Harker up. He's sort of asleep with his head on the desk. And so he shakes him awake and asks Harker if he can use the Morse apparatus. There's money for him if he can get a message passed on to Palmerdale's brokers in London. Now, this really winds Harker up, doesn't he? Because he remembers that the captain of the ship died because of Palmerdale's desperate hurry to get to London.
Mm.
So his blood's on Palmerdale's hands, basically, and he was a good. His captain was a good man that Harker served under. We don't know for how long, but he's furious with Palmerdale. And this is the last straw, isn't it, to get him to sort out this piece of business which resulted in his captain's death. So he goes absolutely nuts and starts throttling Palmerdale, doesn't he? Skinsell wakes up and intervenes, and then the Doctor flies in and sort of pulls him apart. And then he does one of his disarming remarks, doesn't he? He kind of says with a grin and a chuckle that this lighthouse is under an attack and by morning we might all be dead. Anyone interested?
Yes, fantastic line.
With a big grin at the end.
Yeah. We see the creature again, point of view shot of it, from it, looking back up at the lighthouse. And Vince is up in the lamp room. Reuben joins him, tells him it's time to stoke the boiler again. Vince, though, is worried about the beast, and he asks Reuben if he was serious about it. Reuben draws parallels with what happened the previous time Beast was there. The fact that there were three men, and there are currently three men. So this scares Vince even more, and Reuben realises that, you know, what he's saying is upsetting him, so he says that he'll go and stoke the boiler himself, and he leaves Vince up there looking after the lamp room, doesn't he?
Yeah, Reuben is saying three men, two dead, one mad. So Vince has to take his choice between dead or mad. If it all happens again, neither of which are really particularly appealing.
No,
I wouldn't wish for either of them. Well, I already have the mad. It's only dead to look forward to. So Palmerdale and Skinsale are sceptical about this attack the Doctor's talking about. At this point, Reuben arrives and it just makes it worse, really, by talking about the Beast of Pain Rock.
Yeah.
So it just makes them both look like idiots. Palmerdale inevitably kind of scoffs at this. Leela's not having it, so and she launches herself at him and holds a knife to his throat. And she says that, he doesn't do what the Doctor says, she'll cut out his heart.
The Doctor grins, doesn't he? And he says, you heard what she said?
he doesn't intervene in any way, does he?
No.
At this point, Leela notices it's getting colder, just like the last time. Just before Ben died, it got colder, didn't it?
Mm.
And they all kind of scoff at this as well, but the Doctor's saying, well, Leela's senses are particularly acute. She says it's getting colder. It is getting colder. Adelaide arrives at this point, and then the lights go dim, just briefly, don't they? They click on and off. Reuben's down in the boiler room at this point as the lights dim. He goes to check the dials and kind of shakes his head sardonically, you know, thinking, oh, this electricity, basically, in his head, moaning about it again. Then he heads to the dreaded coal hole, doesn't he?
Yes.
He passes Ben's corpse and makes a sign of the cross again. Then he opens the door to the coal hole and goes in.
Yes, he does. And then upstairs, Adelaide asks Lord Palmerdale what's going on. And he says, nothing, my dear. Absolutely nothing is happening here. And then the lights go out, and Reuben screams horribly.
Horribly.
Which should be the end of the episode, but unfortunately, the Doctor and Leela rush out of the room, and Adelaide runs over to Skinsale, who says, what the devil was that? And I just think, you know, why? Just stop it at the scream.
Yeah, I think so as well. That seemed very strange when it ended with him saying, what the devil was that?
Yeah, I just think it would have been much more effective if they just stopped with the scream, you know, and it could have just, the scream could have just melded into the music.
Well, this era of the show, there was that scream before the music starts, isn't there? That part of the theme tune, isn't it?
Yeah,
that would have been really good, actually, if they'd done it that way. You can have What the Devil Is That in the recap, can't you, next time?
Of course. That should be the first thing in the recap. But, yeah, I mean, it's still a good episode ending, but it just could have been slightly better just by a better bit of editing, I think.
Yeah, well, it's just a decision where it ends, isn't it? It's just we'll chop it there and then run it from there next time. Yeah. Anyway, part three. Doctor and Leela rush down to the generator room. They find it empty, but the door to the outside is open, and they go out. Adelaide, as she does for much of part three, is absolutely hysterical in the crew room.
Mm.
Saying that she should have listened to her stars. She's got some woman who is supposed to be very reliable in astrology. She gave Adelaide a reading saying that something terrible was going to happen, and Adelaide ignored it. Palmerdale is utterly unsympathetic. He doesn't, despite what Adelaide thinks, he really doesn't give a jot about her, does he?
No.
He's clearly sort of stringing her along somehow. Harker, who's the only person with a set of cojones in the entire crew, goes down to see what's happening at the base of the lighthouse. Palmerdale, conversely, says they should all stick together. And Skinsale, probably quite insightfully, wonders if this is to make sure that the attacker satisfies its appetite before reaching Palmerdale. Which Palmerdale doesn't like very much, and it makes Adelaide go absolutely ape thingy.
Yeah, it does.
Yes.
Harker goes down to the boiler room, and he opens the door and calls outside to the Doctor. He doesn't get a response. He goes back in and he sees Reuben coming out of the coal hole. Reuben kind of shuffles past in a trance, doesn't he?
Mm.
He just says, leave me be. And he heads upstairs. Harker continues to call out for the Doctor. And on the stairs, Reuben hears the siren, and he kind of looks up, doesn't he? And up in the lamp room, Vince is kind of up there, he's shivering, and the lights come back on. And then in the crew room, they hear something outside. Skinsell goes to the door, and he first looks down, and then you see Reuben shuffling past, but for some reason Skinsell doesn't see him immediately, does he?
Or doesn't even hear the direction this heavy tread is going in.
Yeah, it's a bit daft. But then he does notice him, and he goes back and he just says, "Oh, it was the old fellow getting up the stairs." He said he looked done in.
He actually is done in terms of death. Well, sort of, but we'll come to that later.
Yes.
So the Doctor and Leela come back from outside and back into the generator room and find Harker there. Obviously, they went over to look for Reuben, and you know, due to the cry, they think something terrible's happened to him. But Harker says, no, he's all right. He just had a word with him and he walked up the stairs. The Doctor isn't convinced by this, is he? And he starts reciting an electrical formula. He goes and touches the generator and gets zapped by some more sort of residual static, doesn't he?
Yeah, and then he starts spouting some sort of techno babble, doesn't he? And the other two, Leela and Harker, are talking about Reuben. The Doctor's kind of distracted, talking to himself, really. And then he suddenly stops and he says, where's Reuben? Oh, he's gone upstairs. He says, well, why didn't you tell me? They go, well, we are telling you. He says, why am I standing here trying to work out his size? Reuben can tell me. And Leela says, well, that's what I thought, but I'm only a savage. And then it sort of says, yes, come along, savage. And they head up and they head up the stairs. He tells Harker to try and secure the door, doesn't he? And he and Leela head upstairs.
Yeah, that's one of those that's one of those nasty tasks people get allocated in this sort of story, isn't it? So you go ahead and see if everything's all right. And you know they'll be dead within seconds.
Yeah.
So back to the crew room. Palmerdown is now trying to get Skinsell to send his message to his brokers for him. Skinsell refuses. Then the Doctor and Leela by this time have arrived looking for Reuben. Skinsell says he saw him and that Reuben looked a little bit groggy. The Doctor is interested by this. Ignores Adelaide's question about what that terrible cry was they heard, and they head off. Adelaide is fed up with the Doctor and Leela by now, and starts complaining about them. Palmerdale then heads off up the stairs. Skinsell is very suspicious of Palmerdale, and he gets nervous by this.
There's a good line there, isn't there? He says, some people make him nervous when he's with them. Palmerdale has the opposite effect. He's nervous when he's out of his sight.
Yes. So he then goes off to follow Palmerdale and see what he's up to, because it won't be anything good, leaving the hysterical Adelaide on her own.
Yeah. The Doctor tries the door to the... I guess it's the bunk room, is it?
Mm.
It's locked, and he knocks and calls out to Reuben. Inside, Reuben's kind of just standing there, isn't he? He's standing rigid, and he's glowing green, isn't he?
Yeah.
Obviously, he doesn't reply. Leela asks, what's going on? She asks why Reuben isn't replying. The Doctor says, he's not listening. He thinks maybe the shock's closed his mind. It could be hours or even days before he recovers from it. He tells Leela to go and tell Harker to keep the boiler pressure up. And she heads down, kind of repeating this phrase to herself, doesn't she? Because she obviously hasn't got a clue what it means. Up in the lamp room, Palmerdale's having a chat with Vince, being nice to him so we know he's up to something.
Yeah.
And he tries to bribe him to use the telegraph. He's trying everybody else, so now he's having to go with Vince. He wants him to get to send this message to London, and he offers him £50. And Vince is like absolutely flabbergasted, isn't he? He's never known so much money, and he says he doesn't want to get mixed up in anything wrong, but this money's a fortune to him, so he reluctantly kind of takes it, doesn't he?
Well, it turns out to be £100, because it's £50 now, cash in hand, and then £50 afterwards, isn't it?
That's right.
Because that's all Palmerdale had on him.
Mm.
These massive Edwardian
notes.
Notes, yeah, I don't know what denomination they are, but they're enormous, aren't they?
Yeah. But this has been overseen by Skinsell, hasn't it? Who's, on the stairs. Meanwhile, there's a shot of the lighthouse, and we see this green blob of the creature climbing up the outside. Apparently it's like a wire-hung puppet, and it looks like a wire-hung puppet. Not very good.
Yeah, they've merged some CSO. I think the CSO is the lighthouse, isn't it? And then they drag this little puppet up against the blue screen. Yeah, it doesn't look particularly good, unfortunately.
Now, this confuses me. The Reuben that's in the bunk room isn't the body of Reuben, is it?
No.
So what is it?
It's the Reuben turning into a replica of Reuben. That's why we see it changing, turning green. Then it goes up, the window goes up.
Mm. So it's on the outside of the lighthouse.
Mm.
You see, I thought the idea of this was that the Reuben changes form and becomes Reuben. But they're not even in the same place. Doesn't quite make sense to me.
Well, you never see Reuben in the room whilst the Reuben is somewhere else. You don't see him look out of the window, but that's what's happened, isn't it? Him turning green was him turning back into Reuben form, which it uses to climb up the lighthouse.
Okay.
The problem is you never see it do it.
Oh, right. So the implication is that it's gone out of the window as the Reuben, it's gone up, and then it comes back.
Yeah, because we know from when the Doctor hangs off the window of the bunk room that is the side of the lighthouse that the Reuben goes up. So that's what the Reuben does. It changes from Reuben back into its normal form, climbs up, zaps Palmerdale, comes back down again, changes back into Reuben. But I know what you mean. It's not clear.
No, I didn't put two and two together there. I thought it was just a plot hole. But
I'm pretty sure that's what it is, but it's not. The viewer has to feel quite a lot in themselves, I think.
Mm.
You don't see him heading towards a window or anything, or change. Well, that's because they don't want to reveal the Reuben as Reuben yet, I think, for some reason. I mean, we know that that's not the right Reuben, don't we? Because
yeah.
He's obviously very odd, and his skin doesn't look at all well.
No, that's true. But
anyway, I'm pretty sure that's how it works.
Okay, fine.
So back in the lab room, Palmerdale gives the message that he wants Vince to deliver. It's written in a code that apparently his brokers will understand, but no one else will. So whatever this business secret that Skintel's given him is not going to be leaked on the way to Palmerdale's brokers. Obviously, it's going to be a big scoop, you know, with that insider information means that he can buy shares in something which will suddenly rocket.
Mm.
But the Doctor is heard approaching up the stairs. Palmerdale quickly tells Vince to say nothing about their little agreement. And then he scuttles out, doesn't he, onto the lamp gallery, leaving Vincent to confront the Doctor.
Mm. Downstairs in the boiler room, Harker is securing the door. He's got a kind of a wooden stake that he uses to do that. Leela picks up the sledgehammer that he's kind of used to knock that in into place. And she sort of says to herself, solid oak, because the Doctor's referred to the fact that the door to the bunk room is made from solid oak. And she starts to practice swing with this sledgehammer, doesn't she? She also gives Harker the Doctor's message. Can he keep the boy pressure up? And Harker says, boiler pressure, miss. He goes, that is what I said. very good.
It's brilliant, isn't it? This reminds me of something that I did as a child. She's quite childish in some ways, isn't she, Leela?
Yeah.
Because she's not unintelligent. She's just uneducated. Isn't she?
Yeah.
But she's quite sort of childlike. And my brother Rob will listen to this and will like this anecdote. We were putting some felt on the roof of a shed in our garden, and my older brother told me to go and get a claw hammer from my dad, who was in the house.
Yeah.
So I climbed down off this roof, and I wondered if I'd been repeating this claw hammer. And when I got to my dad, I asked him whether they had a claw hammer. And he probably said claw hammer, and I probably said, that is what I said. Or something very similar. Anyway, it's a nice, insightful piece of writing, I think.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so up in the lamp room, Vince is worrying about the beast again, isn't he? The Doctor tells him it's superstitious nonsense. And he says that, you know, anyway, they've got an advantage over the creature. There's eight of them, so that, you know, they've got an 8-to-1 advantage. But outside, the creature has reached the edge of the gallery just below where Palmerdale's outside walking around. Yeah, we see the green glow, and Palmerdale looks over the side, and he gets tentacled, doesn't he, by this creature. His tentacle reaches up and wraps around his neck, and he's electrified. And that's the end of Palmerdale.
It is, yeah, thank God.
Not a very nice character, was he?
No, not very pleasant, not good company. This is a reverse shot, isn't it? Back in those days, they used to use video disc, which is a very primitive version of DVD, wasn't it? But because it gave you a decent playback without any distortion or anything like that. So they shot this backwards and then played it forwards on video disc. So if you look, I didn't notice this first time. It's one of those things, isn't it, that if you're not looking for it, you don't notice it. But when you read the information notes on the DVD, it tells you what's going to happen, and then you know. And it suddenly looks very backwards, doesn't it? Palmerdale the actor starts off with the tentacle around his neck, screaming. Then the tentacle is withdrawn, and he steps back, sort of looks curiously over the rail, and then stands back afterwards. Mm. And it all comes the opposite direction. But you don't notice it first time. Oh, I didn't.
I didn't notice it at all.
They use the same effect later on for another same sort of situation. And again, I didn't notice until it had been explained. So, well done, BBC.
Yes, excellent. Down in the crew room, Adelaide is whinging again.
You surprised me.
She's arguing with Skinsale about Lord Palmerdale. She says that he's been very good to her, and she knows that he's been very generous to Skinsale. But Skinsale says that Palmerdale will make far more from him than the other way round. And he says that he's a crook and a skunk.
Skunk is brilliant. You don't expect that, actually.
No.
I had to play it back a couple of times to make sure that's what he said.
This makes Adelaide very angry, and she storms out, saying that she'll find Lord Palmerdale and tell him exactly what Skinsale has said. She slams the door behind her. And Skinsale kind of laughs to himself and says, "I thought you might." And he moves purposefully over towards the telegraph machine, doesn't he?
He does, yes. Meanwhile, Leela, who's getting quite familiar with this sledgehammer, swinging it around, much to Harker's horror, she arrives outside the door of the bunk room, and she threatens to knock the door down unless Reuben within unlocks it. And Reuben, by this stage, the Reuben has come back down the hall and returned there, so you do actually see him in the room, don't you?
Mm.
Up in the lamp room, the doctor tells Vince to stay where he is, keep the siren going. He hears a banging noise, which is Leela trashing the bunkroom door, and heads downstairs to find her doing it. He stops her. At this point, Adelaide arrives and comes up the stairs, and he just basically bellows her to get back to the crew room, which she obeys immediately, but probably doesn't like very much. And it's quite a nice end to this little scene, isn't there? The doctor just basically... it says to Leela, "The Malicious Damage Act of 1861 covers lighthouses." Leela just sort of looks in blankly.
Yeah, it's great. Vince goes out onto the gallery balcony bit looking for Palmerdale, who's obviously not there anymore. Horrified, he rushes back in. He goes over to the speaking tube. Then he kind of thinks twice. And he takes the money from his pocket, doesn't he? And he sets it alight. He's obviously worried that if he's found with the money, they'll think it was him that stole it from him, I guess.
Yeah, quite wise for someone who's treated as quite dim throughout this whole thing.
Yeah.
So it's horrible, though, isn't it? That's an absolute fortune, 100 quid, sorry, 50 quid at this stage, isn't it, to Vince, and he's just setting fire to it so he doesn't get into trouble. That must be quite difficult for him to do, but he knows what he has to do, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
So the doctor arrives to Skinsale and Adelaide and has to basically grasp the nettle and tell them about the alien.
Mm.
Of course, they don't believe it. And Skinsale makes a joke about H.G. Wells. The doctor says, well, Herbert may have had a few facts wrong, but his basic supposition is correct, which is one of several references to H.G. Wells, isn't it, during the history of the show, most horrible of which was Time Lash. But Vince gets on the blower, and he tells the doctor that he thinks Palmerdale has fallen from the lamp gallery. Adelaide screams again, and Leela slaps her in the face.
Yeah, fantastic. Skinsale can't believe that Palmerdale fell, and nor can the Doctor. And at this point, Skinsdale starts to realise that the Doctor is serious about this alien creature, isn't he? The Doctor tells Leader to stay put, and he, Harker, and Skinsdale go to check on Palmerdale outside. But as they leave, you see the form of Reuben standing on the stairs in shadows behind them, isn't it?
Yeah, quite menacing.
Leela closes the door. Adelaide's still snivelling, babbling about there being tragedy predicted in her stars again. Leela thinks she's talking about her shaman, doesn't she?
Yeah. It always comes back to the tribes, doesn't it, with Leela?
Yeah. But, you know, Adelaide says that she's talking about her astrologer that she consults every month. Leela says it's a waste of time. She used to believe in magic, but the Doctor has taught her about science. It's better to believe in science.
It's great, isn't it? It's all the excellent sort of Professor Higgins and Eliza Doolittle thing that goes on with the Doctor and Leela, and most obviously in Talensung Chiang, where they're actually sort of in that era. And well, various people actually teach it about muffins and all the rest of it, including Professor Lightfoot. But I think it's one of the really interesting things about Leela's character. It's really, really one of my favourite companions.
Yeah, definitely.
But the Doctor comes in from outside. It comes carrying a surprisingly intact Palmerdale, considering he's fallen from that height. He's absolutely splattered. Skinsale follows him in, and Harker secures the door behind them. The Doctor, knowing that Adelaide is in the room, couldn't care less as he comes in with his corpse on his shoulders. And Adelaide, predictably, goes absolutely hysterical again. Leela has a quick word with Skinsale and says, you know, has Adelaide never seen death before? Basically shakes his head. Then Adelaide goes berserk and she accuses Skinsale of killing Palmerdale. Because obviously at the time of his death he'd already left to see what Palmerdale was up to, so as far as she's concerned he doesn't have any kind of alibi.
Adelaide continues to whine and Leela eventually pushes her back into a chair and shouts enough at her, doesn't she? The Doctor asks Skinsale what he was up to, and he says that Palmerdale had been trying to bribe Vince. And the Doctor says, ah, so you came down here and wrecked the telegraph. And Skinsale admits it. He says it was the only way of protecting his honour. The Doctor points out that in so doing, he's put all of their lives in danger. They've now got no way of contacting the mainland.
This is a brilliant bit from Tom Baker, isn't it? It's just that deadly serious bit. In saving your honour, you put all our lives in danger. Yeah. There's another lovely, lovely bit right at the cliffhanger of this episode. And that really, I think, is, although he's great at the comedy, that is Tom Baker at his best, the absolutely terrifyingly serious stuff he does.
Well, he loses that completely in a couple of seasons' time. It's just too, you know, it's all comedy, or what you think is comedy. And sometimes it's very wide of the mark.
And doesn't the show suffer as a result?
Yeah, definitely.
Really badly. Yeah. So then the strangely odd Reuben finds Harker in the boiler room. He favours him with a terrible, evil smile, doesn't he?
He does.
Really, quite chilling, isn't it? Really unpleasant face that he pulls.
Creepy.
And just at that point, we see Vince up in the lamp room trying the foghorn, and there's no pressure because Harker is not stoking the boiler anymore, for obvious reasons.
The Skinsale is pleading his innocence to Adelaide, isn't he? He suggests it may have been Harker, because he saw him attack him earlier. But the Doctor says no, he was electrocuted, same way as Ben was.
Yeah, dead before he hit the ground.
Exactly, so it's obviously the creature that's done it. And Skinsale points out, you know, that must mean it can climb sheer walls. The Doctor says yes, and it's amphibious, it's got an affinity with electricity, it can affect the temperature, and it likes the cold. He thinks that maybe they could use heat as a weapon against it. And then we get Vince on the blower again, and he says, he passes the message through Leela to say that the boiler pressure has fallen, the siren isn't working. And immediately the Doctor's worried about Harker, and they all go down to see what's happened.
Yeah, foolishly Adelaide follows. So inevitably the Doctor and Leela find Harker dead in the generator room. And it's a ghastly sort of rictus on his face, isn't it? It really is grim, isn't it? It's a good performance from Rio Fanning, who plays Harker, a fantastic name. And unfortunately, Skinsale, followed by Adelaide, arrive, and Adelaide goes absolutely nuts again. and the Doctor just bellows to Skinsell to get her out of it. And then they've got a bit more of a kind of shifty round, don't they? And they find Reuben in the coal hole with rigor mortis, which is not a good sign, as seconds earlier they saw him wandering about.
Must have been creaking a bit, I think.
So he reveals the fact that Reuben has actually been dead for hours.
Oh!
Yes. Then Tom Baker elects to pronounce chameleon as chameleon for some reason. He talks about the chameleon factor, sometimes called lycanthropy, which normally is used to talk about werewolves, but it actually means any kind of shape changing, I think.
Yeah.
So he's obviously worked out this alien as a shape changer and has assumed Reuben's form. And then it's just what I was talking about with one of his wonderful moments of absolute seriousness. He just says at the end of the episode, "Leela, I've made a terrible mistake. I thought I'd locked the enemy out. Instead, I've locked it in with us."
Mm.
Which is a fantastic ending, isn't it?
It is great, yeah.
Considering it's just a line of dialogue, isn't it, rather than something big happening. It's really powerful.
I think, yeah, it's the best one so far, I think. So we're into the final part. Vince is upstairs on a foghorn still, and Reuben arrives. He startles him, doesn't he? Vince says to him, you know, "Oh, you should go back down and get some sleep. You're not looking too good." And Reuben just grins at him. His horrible, creepy smile. Vince realises something's wrong. He starts to back away. But Reuben grabs him by the arm, and then he places his other hand on his head, doesn't he, and shocks him. And that's the end of poor old Vince.
Yes, his woolly hat is no protection.
No.
From the sheer current that is flying through.
Oh, that's really sad to see Vince go.
Yeah, he's really likable, isn't he, Vince?
Mm.
Yeah, it's a horrible scene, particularly to be killed by what appears to be Reuben. You know, he's kind of mentor.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, nasty. Anyway, Leela and the Doctor are discussing, you know, the shape-changing nature of the alien.
Sorry, just as they go back to this, because you've just seen Reuben, or what we think is Reuben, kill Vince, and then it cuts to the Doctor and Leela down below with a dead Reuben, and he appears to breathe and move a finger, unfortunately.
Oh, does he? I never noticed.
Yeah.
Doctor, he's all right.
The rigor mortis hasn't set in as much as we thought.
he's recovered from the rigor mortis. It's a medical miracle. Yes, despite all this happening with Reuben, they're discussing the shape-changing nature of the alien. You know, the Doctor saying, you know, how difficult this will be to deal with. But Leela saying, "Ah, yes, but you're a Time Lord." And you can't really work out, can you, whether she's taking a mick or not.
Yeah.
Until... Yeah, the Doctor basically says, "Oh, yeah, that's not going to help me," sort of thing, and walks off, and you see her smiling.
Yes.
But there is a school of thought, isn't there, that she's kind of sort of corpsed, isn't she, Louise Jameson? She's laughing when she should be laughing. She shouldn't be caught on camera laughing. Mm. Apparently, this is kind of reinforced by the fact that during this entire scene, where you've just got a one shot on Louise Jameson, Baker is pulling faces throughout this speech that she has to make. Really trying to make her laugh. It might be that laugh at the end, although it's not out of character. She appears to be taking the mick, but we can't always tell with Leela, because she has got a sense of humour, but she's also very deadpan about things as well.
Mm.
Certainly on the information notes, it says that this was scripted, that Leela should smile at this point. But anyway, she's saying that why don't we pretend that we think it's still the normal Reuben and then, you know, attack it when we get close enough. And the Doctor says we can't get close enough, it packs too many volts. He has a look around the generator and he finds this sort of silver tube, which doesn't look very Edwardian. And he reckons it's an alien power relay attached to the generator to power a distress beacon somewhere else. You kind of hear his sort of thoughts, don't you? He kind of thinks aloud. He says there's probably a signal modulator transmitting to his own kind. So he tells Leela to get the others up to the lamp room because it's the easiest place to defend. And then another brilliant line from Leela, isn't it? She says, "Where should we look for this Mognal singulate?" So she heard roughly what he said, but because she didn't understand it, she's just tried to repeat it.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant, isn't it? It's really quite an endearing quality, I think, for Leela.
Yeah.
She's so enthusiastic, but she doesn't always get it right.
Yeah, it's great. Upstairs, Skinsale and Adelaide are in the crew room. She's still shrieking. Leda comes in and she tells them that Harker's dead and that the creature's in the lighthouse and they're going to have to fight for their lives, at which point Adelaide faints. And Leela just rolls her eyes.
That's great. She's so unlike Leela, isn't she, Adelaide?
Yeah.
She's the opposite of Leela. The doctor appears to be in the bunk room, doesn't he? He appears to be found some dirty postcards, doesn't he?
He does.
Under someone's bunk. And they don't even seem to be contemporary for that time, don't you think?
They look like kind of saucy seaside postcards, don't they?
Yeah, I think they were around in those, but I don't think they looked like that then. No. These look far too modern. But
I'm not a connoisseur of dirty postcards, Jip, but I'll take your word for it.
nor am I. I know nothing about them.
No, that doesn't sound like you do.
They don't, from my limited knowledge, they don't look they're from the right era. But anyway.
I'd have thought, actually, maybe they belong to the Rutan, not to Reuben.
Yeah. Maybe he had them in his spaceship and he brought them in his gelatinous pocket.
His gelatinous green sack.
If that's nicer, yeah.
Well, it's not really nicer, but, you know.
No, it's considerably less nice, I think. Yes, but anyway, Reuben, with gelatinous sack or not, goes past the closed, although slightly wrecked, door of the bunk room. He seems to sense there's something in a room, doesn't he? Because he kind of stops in passing and then comes in. He sees the room apparently empty and he pulls back the curtain where the doctor's hidden behind and there's an open window. The doctor is hanging outside from the window ledge by his fingertips, you know, his body hanging down the side of the lighthouse. I actually think this doesn't look too bad.
No, it's okay.
Because normally the problem with CSO is that the lighting on whoever's been inserted into the CSO picture is not the same as the lighting of the picture they've been inserted into. Somehow there seems to be some sort of parity here, and it actually looks like it could be him hanging out there. Yeah. And it actually looks really good, actually.
Yeah, I think it looks fine. I think it might be slightly too big. Perhaps,
that's true.
Other
than
that, yeah.
The scale may not be right, but he looks like he fits in the picture at least. But anyway, at this point, Reuben obviously can't see anything. He can't see any Time Lord fingers on the sill. So he turns and leaves.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
The Skinsale is trying to get Adelaide to drink something.
It's Rohypnol, probably.
Probably, yeah. No, he's probably trying to get Leela to drink that.
Actually, that's more likely.
Leela is trying to convince them to go with her up to the lamp room. At which point, Reuben arrives, doesn't he? Leela kind of draws her knife, and Reuben, smiling, enters the room, looking very menacing. We then see the doctor clambering back in through the window, and luckily he seems to have found the module signalator. He's got this kind of device that he must have found outside.
It's a portable TV aerial, I think.
Yeah, that's what it is, but I think it's supposed to be the signal modulator.
Yeah, he holds it up with some triumph, doesn't he?
Yes, and then a scene that most people would have found really satisfying. Reuben kills Adelaide.
Hey!
And stops her shrieking, you know.
That's a permanent end to her shrieking.
He does, thankfully.
Don't you think this is slightly odd, though, isn't it? Because Leela was right in front of the doorway with a knife. And the next time you see Adelaide's right next to the doorway being killed, and Leela and Skinsale at the other end of the room, still holding a knife.
Yeah, well, I guess what they must have done was just pushed her towards the creature.
Yes. Go on, Adelaide, sacrifice yourself.
Yeah, it was a bit strange, but
satisfying nonetheless.
Satisfying, yes. Leela and Skinsale run, don't they? And Leela throws a knife at Reuben. But he just kind of glows green, and the knife appears to vanish, doesn't it? I didn't really see it drop to the floor, but as we see a bit later, it does.
Yeah, it looks like he's kind of absorbed it somehow, doesn't it? But it does. It is on the floor later, isn't it?
He must crap it out again at some point.
Yeah, he eats it for breakfast and craps it out before lunch.
Yes.
Which is nice. She doesn't wipe it when she picks it up, unfortunately. She puts it straight in her boot. But anyway, Leela has run out, and everyone bumps into the doctor on the stairs, don't they?
Yeah.
The doctor tells Skintail to find the maroons upstairs, which are kind of flares, aren't they? And he tells him to sprinkle the powder down the lamp room stairs. He says Vince up in the lamp room will help them, but we know that's not going to happen.
No.
His days of helping people are long gone. So Skintail and Leela go up. And then I think, and I don't know what you think about this, Martin, but I think the tension is just siphoned out of this story at this point. The doctor sits down on the stairs and starts taunting Reuben the Reuton, as he calls him.
Mm.
Because he's no longer apparently scared, I think it's important that the doctor is scared or at least worried. The moment he appears not to be, which is a problem, I think, with a lot of New Who, is the doctor often doesn't appear worried enough about stuff. And if he's not worried, then why the hell should the audience be worried? And I think this is one of the only things I would say against this story is this scene, really, or this succession of scenes which starts here. He sits down on the stairs and he starts calling him Reuben the Reuton because he's worked out what race is. And he's telling me how hard it must be for him to maintain human shape. Reuben says it's no longer necessary and then basically turns Reuton, i.e. a sort of glowing, slimy-looking green ball with sort of tendrils hanging off it.
Mm. Yeah, I don't entirely agree. I think normally when the Doctor, you know, eventually has the face-off with the monster or the villain, he will appear to be more confident. It didn't jar with me. I don't think the Reuton's very good, but I thought the scene was fine because he's kind of taunting it, and he knows that he's kind of figured out a way of hurting it, hasn't he? So I just thought he's just trying to tempt it upstairs so that they can get it with the gunpowder.
Yeah, I think you can do that as an actor and still maintain. Well, it's difficult, but I think you still maintain a shred of nervousness.
Mm.
And I think that would have helped because the Reuton isn't realised that well. It's just one of those things, unless you approach these things with absolute conviction, which we found out later on with particularly the penultimate season of Tom Baker.
Mm.
If he's not treating it seriously, then it becomes pointless. It becomes a comedy show.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's got to this stage yet, but this is the sort of thing that if you amplified, you'd end up with that, you know, the attitude of the show in that season.
Yeah, I don't think it's anywhere near that, though. I think
that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. It's not as bad as that, but this is—it feels like the seeds of it. You know, Baker is at his best when he's serious, and it doesn't always work. Although he's brilliant at comedy, it doesn't always work when the comedy isn't in the right place.
Mm.
And for me, it just felt—I think you can taunt someone and still hold something back. You know, that you're actually worried about your adversary, even though you're taunting them. And, you know, he has done it, and other actors playing the Doctor have done it as well. And I just wish that happened in this scene. Because he's just sitting down casually, isn't he?
Yeah.
Taking the mick out of this thing. And it undermines the power of the Reuton, doesn't it? And the Reuton just, you know, it immediately sounds like he's just spouting sort of saber-rattling rhetoric, doesn't it? Which it is.
Mm.
And they're very like the Sontarans in that way, aren't they? They're just like banging on about, you know, all this kind of bellicose stuff about fighting wars all the time.
Mm.
And, you know, they're well matched in that sense. But for me, this is just, you know, there aren't many low points in this. This is the one that doesn't work quite right for me.
Okay. For me, I didn't feel the same. I thought it was fine. But I take your point. I guess it could be like the seeds of that. But no, I thought it was all right. So back up in the lamp room, Skinsale has found Vince's dead body, and Leela is basically taking the maroons out of a box. Skinsale starts to help her, and then they hear the static noise on the stairs, and the doctor is talking to Reuben the Reuton. Yeah, he's clearly met them before. It's a Reuton scout who's been trained in the new metamorphosis techniques. I think there's a good point of view shot when the doctor is sitting there, actually, when they're talking. Mm. The Reuton's looking up at him. It's less good when you see it on the stairs because it does look as if it's right next to him and could quite easily just reach out a tentacle and get him.
So, yeah, that's the problem because it's overlaid, isn't it? Because Tom Baker's sitting on that set alone, isn't he?
Mm.
And this thing is overlaid on it. And although he's looking in the right direction, which doesn't always happen, It's not there, and it is within striking distance. But
Yeah.
maybe the Rutan is interested in the chat before it kills him. Interesting that Rutan sounds exactly like Morbius, doesn't it?
Who does the voice for it? Do you know?
It's Colin Douglas again.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It's the actor who plays Reuben, which is interesting because at one point he almost sounds like Reuben, doesn't he? So it doesn't concern you. When he's being the Rutan.
That's true.
Whereas the rest of it doesn't actually sound like Reuben, but at that point he kind of falls back into Reuben. It's interesting, isn't it, that the Rutan uses the royal we, doesn't it? Yeah, it's a we do this, we arrived here, we did this. It's obviously some kind of gestalt entity, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think it's a nice touch to say that it's this particular scout has been specially trained in the new metamorphosis techniques.
Mm.
I mean, obviously, you know, they can metamorphosize, but it's interesting that this is them sort of pioneering it.
Mm. Yeah, that's good.
Because as the doctor says, I haven't got it quite right. You know, I mean, if you look at Reuben the Rutan, and you look at Reuben without any Rutan influence, and the normal Rutan is a lot healthier. But another thing about that Colin Douglas is well chosen. I mean, he looks like an old sea salt, doesn't he? But also, he's a big fella, isn't he? So he is quite menacing when he's taken over.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, the Doctor and Reuben the Rutan have this conversation. We find out a little bit about the Rutans that have been at war with the Sontarans. The Doctor thinks they're starting to lose that war. Apparently, they used to control the Mutter Spiral, but now the Sontarans have forced them to the far reaches of the galaxy. The Rutan counters this by saying that they're making a series of strategic withdrawals. I thought it was quite a good line.
That's a great euphemism, isn't it?
Yeah. And the Doctor says, Rutan, that's the empty rhetoric of a defeated dictator. And I don't like your face either. Which I thought was good.
Yeah, it's this actually struck terror on me as a 9-year-old watching this when it was screened. Because I was so scared of the Sontarans that I thought they were going to turn up as soon as they got mentioned. I was just, I really didn't want them to turn up, because they do turn up a few episodes later, a few stories later. And they're crap.
They are absolutely rubbish. But never mind.
But never mind, yes.
Let it go, Jim.
Yeah, I can't. I can't let it go. I simply can't. So the Rutan doesn't appreciate this mockery, does he? And he starts spouting the rhetoric. He says they're going to invade the planet and destroy the Earthlings. The Doctor questions, what's the point? The Rutan says, the strategic position of Earth is useful to them, the Rutans, and they can use it as a launch point for their final assault on the Sontaran rabble. Which is a great line, isn't it?
It is brilliant.
The Doctor at this point gets a little bit worried, doesn't he? Because he realises that if they make Earth their power base, it's going to be bombarded with photonic missiles by the Sontarans.
Mm.
The Rutan doesn't really care about what happens to the Earth or its primitive bipeds. And the Doctor kind of wonders why it's killing all the individuals on the lighthouse. And the Rutan is saying, well, it has to wipe them all out before going back to the mothership and contacting the fleet to bring them down to invade. Because he doesn't want anyone else to know about the Rutan visit to Earth. So, you know, it's just, you know, like, silence everybody, bring the mothership down, you know, and they'll have no warning, will they?
That's right. And when he mentions that it's sending this signal to the mothership, the Doctor just grins at it and waves the signal modulator and says, you're not, you know.
Yeah.
The Rutan says, well, it's unimportant. They'll just home in on the primary signal. And the Doctor says, I fixed that as well, Oyster Face.
It's remarkably undeterred, though, isn't it, this Rutan?
Yeah.
Even after two of these things, it still carries on saying, well, the ship will have located the origin of the signal already and be on its way.
Yeah, and it's right.
Yeah, well, the Doctor says, you'll be Deborah the time it arrives, so you know, what good is that going to do you?
Mm.
So the Rutan sort of scoffs at that, and the Doctor runs off, asking it to step this way. I don't know if a ball can step in any direction, but it does follow him.
Yeah, it follows very, very slowly, doesn't it? So the Doctor runs up into the lamp room and he asks himself for a match. And then he goes back to the stairwell. He strikes it against the wall, doesn't he?
No safety matches in those days, of course.
Oh, no, definitely not. And he throws it down, presumably at the powder trail that they've left from the macaroons.
Macaroons? I mean, a coconut trail.
And there's a big flash and big ball of smoke, and the root and screeches of the spears, isn't it?
Yeah, quite a strange scream, didn't you think?
Yeah.
Quite odd. But yeah, anyway, the doctor flaps away the smoke with his scarf, doesn't he? Skintail says, "That's the most horrible thing I've ever seen. What the devil is it?" And the doctor says, "It's an intelligent, highly aggressive species from Router 3. It turns out it evolved in the sea, so Lele was right, really, when she wondered whether it was a sea creature, and adapted to land, although clearly not the land of Earth. And the doctor later says that Router 3 is an icy planet, so they find heat intensely painful. So that's how he knew to whack up some fire and scorch its green behind.
he says they could do with a flamethrower. And Skinsell says, "Oh, there's this." And he's brought this kind of mortar thing up from the service room, hasn't he? The doctor looks at it and he says, "It's an early Shabirli," which is kind of like a rocket launcher thing, which they used to use on boats to fire rope over long distances, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a rocket with a line attached to it. The doctor says that's no good. I mean, obviously, because it's just kind of spear the root and, without sort of introducing any heat, which is what the root doesn't like. So he says it's no good. And he tells Skincell to stay calm, which is quite funny because Skincell is completely calm at that point. I mean, he's in army mode, isn't he, at this stage,
yeah.
Skincell. So he makes you wonder whether the doctor's quite calm or not. Well, the doctor creeps out onto the gallery outside the lamp room, and he comes in with this little sort of red cannon looking device. It's never explained what it is. I'm not sure whether it's something that launches the maroons or not, because when they were putting the flares up, they were kind of like little firework rockets which Leela handed to Reuben, but maybe this is how they launch the maroons. But anyway, it's a little red sort of cannon looking device. The doctor says that he thinks they can probably cover the stairs with it, so if the Rootin comes up, they can probably get it with this. He says to everyone to empty their pockets, and Skintail starts to empty his pockets, and he tells Leela to help empty his pockets, because the doctor's pockets are...
notoriously voluminous.
Notoriously, exactly the phrase I was looking for. So Leela thrusts her hand into his front pocket and finds some stuff that they can put into this cannon.
Including some jelly babies.
Yes, there's nothing a Rootin hates more than being hit by hot jelly babies.
Imagine anyway, one of those put in your eye. Been asked.
Oh, you wouldn't wish for it, would you? That's going to smart in the morning.
Definitely.
Anyway, the doctor chooses to reveal at this point there's a whole battle fleet of Rootins outside, or apparently Rootons, which. Everyone calls them from now on, don't they?
Weirdly.
Till the end of the episode. From Rootins to Rootons. Skintail is horrified. We don't know if he's horrified by the pronunciation or the fact that there's tons of these creatures. And then, fabulously, the fourth Doctor actually achieves a proper rendition of a line which the first Doctor failed at. He says to the assembled company that by the time that the Rootins and the Sartorans are finished with the Earth, it'll be like a cinder hanging in space.
Mm.
Take that, William Hartnell.
Take it on your Spanish holiday with you. Yeah, he's worried about the fact that the Rootin fleet is up there as well. But he suddenly has a thought, that, and he thinks that he may be able to deal with both the Rootin Scout and the mothership at the same time. And if he did that, the Rootins might decide it's too dangerous in this area of the galaxy and leave them alone. And he thinks that the Rootin ship might cut its shields at the last minute to save fuel, which obviously would give them an opening to hit it with something. But of course, it needs something like a laser beam. And then Leela wonderfully suggests, why don't they use the lamp? And the doctor kind of turns to her and he says, "Are you suggesting that I adapt it?" And she says, "Yes." She says, "Well, that's a beautiful notion." And Leela just breaks into this wide grin, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's delighted.
Delighted that she's managed to help him.
A savage has come up with this fantastic idea.
Yeah.
But the doctor decides they need a focusing device, a fairly large piece of crystalline carbon. Skincell twigs that a diamond will fit that bill, and he offers one of his diamond cufflinks. And the doctor says, "Well, that's too small." And Skincell says, "Well, Palmerdale always used to carry diamonds. He called them his insurance." But of course, they'll be on Palmerdale, down in the crew room, you know, on his corpse. So we're reminded that the Rutan is still alive at this point and ascending the stairs.
Mm.
And they're setting up this cannon on the stairs. Skinsale wants to come with the doctor to get down there to Palmerdale. Doctor agrees, and he tells Leela not to fire until she sees the green of its tentacles.
Yeah.
Rutan comes up the stairs. She wants to know how the doctor's going to get past the Rutan. He says he's going to use his discretion.
Yeah. So down they go, the doctor and Skinsale, and they reach the crew room. Skinsale goes in and he's searching through Palmerdale's pockets for the diamonds. We see the Rutan slowly approaching. The doctor suggests maybe he's wearing a body belt, and Skinsale is gingerly trying to try not to put his hand down his trousers.
Yeah, he doesn't get down to the meat and two veg.
But he eventually pulls free this body belt and retrieves the little bag of diamonds that's inside, and goes back out to the stairs where the doctor is waiting. And the doctor pulls these diamonds out into his hand, doesn't he? And he chooses one of the right size, and he just chucks the rest of the diamonds down the stairs, doesn't he? And of course, Skinsale gets down on his hands and knees trying to pick him up. And as the doctor runs up the stairs, Skinsale gets tentacled. You know, I thought that was a bit bad, actually, because it's the doctor's fault that he does it, you know, that he gets killed, really, isn't it?
No, it's Skinsale's fault. Well, he's agreed.
Well, it is, but but the doctor probably would have a good idea that he would try and do that.
Yeah, but the thing about the doctor is he's got no interest in any sort of currency, as in anything valuable like that. So he wants it as a piece of crystalline carbon.
Mm.
He gets the biggest bit. He says, right, that'll do. No, I don't need the rest. Skinsale is, he's also kind of venal money grubber himself, isn't he? And this is quite a poetic way for him to go.
Yes, he's come up and so.
Although, yeah, I mean, he's proved his bravery, you know, in the army, and he's proved it here. But he's still got that bit about him, isn't he?
Mm.
He's got that capitalist bit to him. And Doctor Who doesn't reward capitalism, generally speaking. Or greed, certainly. And cupidity.
Certainly doesn't in this story, anyway.
No, so again, he's filmed backwards, isn't he, with the old video disc. Again, it's if you look closely, you can notice it, but otherwise you won't. But it's a good scene.
Mm.
But it's a good way for him to go, really.
Well, it is, isn't it? Kind of like it's shown his good side, and then his death is because of his greed, which his character, although it's, you know, he's got a little bit of a seedy side to him, he is a likeable, kind of a good character, isn't he? As opposed to Palmerdale's horribleness.
Yeah, in a way, it would be better if Palmerdale died that way, but Palmerdale had died after bribing somebody.
Mm.
But, it just shows that the human being can be impossibly noble and thrillingly rotten at the same time.
Yes.
So that's in the Skinsale. The doctor races up into the lamp room as the doctor gets past the cannon and Leela fires it. And what's really good here, I think, is a point of view shot from a Rutan eye view of the cannon firing, isn't there?
Mm.
You see a little flash from the cannon, and there's a terrible scream from the Rutan.
Yeah. And the doctor kind of looks up at Leela and says, "You singed my scarf."
Well, there's a brilliant pause, isn't there? Leela asks if the doctor's all right. And it's an absolute age, isn't it, for Baker actually says, "You singed my scarf." It's not a thank you or anything like that, is it?
No. Anyway, they're not done yet. The doctor tells Leela that Skinsale died with honour.
Which is nice, considering he didn't.
Yeah, it's true. He turns the lamp off, doesn't he? Leela goes down to check on the Rutan, and it's on the stairs, dying. It's kind of slithering down, isn't it? And the bits falling off it.
See, this is, I think, the one moment where the Rutan is realised really well. It's slipping down the steps, and it looks absolutely wrecked, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And Leela shouts, "Enjoy your death as I enjoyed killing you."
I thought that was a bit over the top, really. I thought it was slightly too far for her.
Well, the doctor tells her up, doesn't he? For it. But, I mean, she's still a warrior, isn't she, at heart? And certainly at this stage, this is what her, including the one she arrives at, this is a fourth story, isn't it?
Mm.
So three stories, if you like, as a companion. She's still going to have that warrior heart, isn't she?
Yeah.
So this mangled Rutan spouts a bit more bellicose rhetoric as it slithers off down the stairs to its death. As we say, the doctor is disgusted that Leela has been celebrating her killing of the Rutan, or the Rutan at this stage, of course. And then he draws her attention to the sky outside, where a fairly crap circle with some flame in it is apparently heading towards him.
I thought that was slightly better realised than the one at the start.
Oh, yeah, it is, but it gets better in a couple of minutes, and you wonder why they didn't use
the
effect they used in a couple of minutes instead of this one, which is like a hole with a flame in it.
Mm.
Anyway, this is the Rick Mothership. The Doctor thinks that using the lighthouse lamp as a kind of laser, he can knock out the anti-grav on this mothership. But he reveals to Leela, once he switches it on, they'll have about 117 seconds to get out of there, which sounds approximate and exact at the same time.
I just thought, with this mothership, it appears to be kind of a ball of flame, doesn't it?
Mm.
Which is, you know, a pretty brave thing to be flying around in if you're scared of heat.
That is a very good point. I never thought of that. Well, that's stupid.
Mm.
That is a shortfall, isn't it, really? It should be made of ice.
It should be. Never mind.
An ice cube hanging in Spain.
Yeah, so the ship gets nearer. The Doctor finishes what he's doing, and he basically switches the thing on, and he and Leela leg it down the stairs. He tells Leela not to look back, doesn't he? Quite forcefully. They rush down. Leela pops into the crew room to retrieve her knife, which we thought had vanished earlier, but it's lying on the floor. The Doctor continues to run, and he calls back to her, doesn't he? And she stops again to put her knife in her boot. And there's a bit of nonsense where he comes running back in as she runs out, isn't there?
Yeah, in the generator.
And then they're back outside. They run for cover and sort of hide behind the rocks, presumably at a safe distance. And Leela kind of looks up, doesn't she, as the ship explodes. I thought that was quite a good effect.
Mm.
You see the lighthouse and you see the like a flash of light coming out from it, don't you? And then the ship exploding. I thought that was quite well done, really.
Because she's looking up at it and it looks like it's happening above somehow, doesn't it?
Mm.
Which is good going, really, for a model and visual effect laid over it.
Yeah.
Good work, fellas.
Well done.
Of course, at this point, the Doctor has told her not to look back and she has looked back. And there's a slight pause, isn't there? And then she hands her knife to the Doctor and asks him to slay her. And he sort of says, hey, I am blind, slay me now. It is the fate of the old and crippled, which is a classic sort of tribal stuff.
Yeah.
Even though I suppose old and crippled is one thing, but old is good, isn't it? Because she was telling Vincey he should talk to the old people of his tribe. But old and crippled is obviously different.
Yes, but, you talk to them just before you slay them.
Yes. I have all your information. You have outlived your usefulness.
Die, old one.
So the Doctor tells her that the effects of the flash will pass and she'll get her sight back. Sure enough, we get a little point of view shot from Leela that shows her sight returning and she focuses back on the Doctor. And the Doctor says, pigmentation dispersal caused by the flash. Your eyes have changed colour. And it turns out her eyes are now blue, which is the natural colour of Louise Jameson's eyes. She obviously had blue eyes when she auditioned for the part of Leela, but they didn't think that blue eyes would be right for a savage.
Mm.
So they gave her brown contact lenses, which she's been wearing throughout. And she was originally contracted to finish Talents of Wing Chiang, I think. And they asked her to stay in for another season, and Louise Jameson said, yeah, but as long as I don't have to wear these contact lenses anymore. So it was written in that her eyes would change colour, and this is how they did it.
Mm. Yeah, it's good. I presume that these brown contact lenses were causing a chip with
it. Yeah, they weren't very comfortable.
Mm.
Unfortunately, Louise Jameson has never looked as hot since, has she? To be sexist for a moment, she looked at her best with brown contact lenses, I thought.
Mm. I never really looked at her eyes.
Oh, God, I thought I was being sexist.
Well, you said, you know, to be sexist for a minute. The minute's up, so we'd have to stop being sexist.
Actually, I think there's quite a few more seconds left. What else can we fit?
Anyway, it finishes with the Doctor quoting lines from a Wilfred Gibson poem, doesn't it? The Flannan Isle, which is quite apt, really, isn't it? It's about three men that go missing.
It's a lot of Mary Celeste, isn't it? There's an untouched meal and an oval-toppled chair. And actually, the Ballad of the Flannan Isle is based on a real event, you know, that Wilfred Gibson wrote about. That is something that Terence Dix was inspired by when he wrote the story, so it's quite nice that he actually put a little bit of it at the end. And it actually altered his original plot, because in his original plot, sure, the Doctor and Leela were going to survive, but Skintell and Adelaide were going to survive as well.
Adelaide?
Yeah, it sounds madness, but they were going to survive. But because everyone on the lighthouse dies in the poem, Terence Dix thought that they should both die, and the only people who should leave would be the two who shouldn't have been there in the first place, which is the Doctor and Leela.
Ah, oh, good stuff.
So art imitates art.
Indeed. The final scene is another model shot of the TARDIS dematerialising, the same one as at the start. And you can hear the Doctor's voice completing the poem over the dematerialisation, can't you?
Some extra echo attached to it.
Yeah, and that's the end of the story.
Yeah, good end.
Good end. Excellent. So, overall thoughts?
Overall thoughts, excellent. Atmospheric, claustrophobic, as it should be in a lighthouse. It's pretty much all self-contained, certainly within the rocks in the lighthouse. It's a base under siege, isn't it? But
yeah,
it's a different feeling one. And there's quite an authentic period feel. And it's unusual to have this straight after Talisman Wing Chiang, isn't it, second Victorian times, which must be after 1888, because I talk about Jet the Ripper. So it's only a decade and a bit probably since then to have another story is quite unusual. Obviously, that wasn't the original running order, but it almost makes the two stories a pair, doesn't it?
Mm.
Which is good, because it's still the Higgins and Doolittle, although that happens throughout the Fourth Doctor and Leela's relationship. It's obviously more obvious when you're in the same kind of era that Big Malin was in, isn't it?
Mm.
It's nice to have those two right together, I think.
Yeah, it's still got a feel of the Hinchcliffe-Holmes era, doesn't it?
If you didn't check who the producer was at the end of each episode, you'd probably still think it was that era, wouldn't you?
Mm.
Bob Holmes is still there, of course.
Yeah, Bob Holmes is still there, script editing. But the whole feel of it, it feels like a Hinchcliffe story.
It does.
It hasn't got the cheapness of a Graham Williams story, which unfortunately is what his era becomes known for, isn't it?
Unfortunately, and it's not really his fault, I don't.
No, probably not. I mean, I think they were just given less and less money.
Well, they're given less money and they're told to make it less scary.
Yeah.
Or less terrific, really, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Or less violent, I suppose.
Yeah, the whole fact that there's darkness throughout it, the small number of people in it, the confined space, everything just makes it just works really well.
Mm.
And again, you know, we got some really good performances. I don't think there was any duff ones. You know, I didn't like the Adelaide character, but it wasn't because the actress wasn't any good. It was just an annoying character.
No, that's Annette Woollett. She did a very good job, as they all did. And they're really well cast as well.
Mm.
Everyone is cast absolutely pinpoint, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, definitely.
Well, when you consider that Rio Fanning, who played Harker, was originally up for Vince, see, that wouldn't have worked at all, would it?
I don't think so.
It worked out much better as it was.
Yeah. The Reuben character of Colin Douglas is fantastic.
He's great in both formats, isn't he, as Reuben and as Reuben the Reuben.
Mm. Yeah.
That smile is one of the most chilling things in Doctor Who, isn't it?
It definitely is, yeah. Tom Baker and Louise Jameson, just top-notch performances, I think, really at their best, working well together.
They are, yeah, and they're kind of cementing that relationship, aren't they?
Mm.
Behind the scenes, it's at this point that Louise Jameson kind of stamps some authority on Baker, because he's already started to feel bigger than show, I think, Tom Baker, at the beginning of this season.
Mm.
And apparently there's this take that she thought Tom Baker was getting wrong each time. And she said, no, can we retake that? Can we retake that? Can we retake that? And eventually they got it right. And apparently Tom Baker had sort of more respect for her after that.
Okay.
So Louise Jameson won a battle here. And I'm not sure what stage in the production that was. But there always was a good relationship, I think, on screen at least, between these two. And it's very good in this one. It's definitely cemented.
Yeah, and it comes across, definitely. So I think both of those, I mean, there's not a lot more to say. I mean, I just love the way that they interplay with each other and some of the dialogue there. It just works really well. The supporting cast, yeah, Reuben is the standout for me. I really like Vince's character.
Mm. I especially love that bit, as I said before, when he gets all embarrassed and the Doctor says that Ben was killed by electricity. It has strange effects. I just love the way he approaches that revelation from the Doctor.
Mm.
Really, really good. He doesn't understand electricity and he just shriveled, didn't he, almost on camera. It's really, really good.
Yeah. And a bit when Leela starts to undress in front of him and he quickly scuttles out of the room.
It's a great performance and it's at times like that you think, well, maybe it's better casting a 32-year-old rather than, you know, a 17-year-old in that role.
Yeah.
To cope with those sort of, you know, slightly more complex emotions.
Yeah, so he does a very good job. Palmerdale, Sean Caffrey, is very good. You know, he's just a nasty piece of work, isn't he? Just looking after number one. Mm. but you know, he's very good.
I think Alan Rowe's skin cell is great, and I think it shows what a versatile actor he is, because in podcast terms, the last time we saw him was a time where he's just feeble king, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He's a much more of a live wire, isn't he, in this one?
He is. Yeah, he gets a much meatier role, really, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
But yeah, he shines, I think. As I said earlier, you kind of get on his side, don't you? He appears to be one of the good ones.
Him and Harker are the ones from the ship that you like, aren't they? And you don't like Palmerdale or Adelaide.
No, definitely not. What about Ben, Ralph Watson?
Yeah, good enough. Yeah, he did what... He's not in it a lot, but he did what he did well, I think.
Yeah, so pretty strong cast. The effects?
Well, the lighthouse and sort of surrounding area, I think, look great. The ship, as you said, is not so good. And certainly the route and scout ship through the air and landing in the water is not at all good. And I think even then they could have done better with that. Mm. We said the doctor hanging from the lighthouse is pretty good. The route and climbing up, not so good. But given that they're approaching the Rutan in that way in mid-ish 70s, it's probably as good as you can expect. And it is quite effective. And certainly when it gets shot and it's sliding down the stairs, I think it looks great. Mm. And it looks all right when it's not doing anything other than sitting there and gliding.
Yeah.
And it's different from a man in a rubber suit. As I said, it's something a bit different.
Yeah, it is. You know, when you go for a phosphorescent green blob, and it looks like a phosphorescent green blob, I mean, that's what you're going to get, isn't it, really?
Tick.
Yeah, it's just when they were making it move, it didn't look particularly good.
It was very slow at climbing the stairs, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a slow climbing the stairs, and the doctor's taking the mick out of it, which removes quite a lot of the threat, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, some people have pointed out before, is that why doesn't it just change back into Reuben again so it can climb the stairs properly?
Well, even he was a bit slow.
He was, but, you know, he had some legs.
And he did have legs, yeah, which is, yeah. Must be advantage, surely.
But the point of view shots were excellent, I thought
that. Yeah, they're great. I always love those. I mean, it's used quite a lot in Doctor Who, but it's a great way of hiding the creature from the audience, but still making it menacing.
Yes, exactly. And I thought the fiery bull mothership at the end was pretty good, actually.
The second version of it was, I thought. The one where it looked like someone had put a candle in front of a hole in a wall didn't look quite so good. But the second one looks convincingly like a fireball. I don't know why they couldn't have used that small to look like it was further away, but they didn't.
Right.
But the sets, I thought, were really good. They felt very authentic. I mean, this is something that the BBC have always done well, and they're certainly doing well back then. Not very many sets, but they were dressed really well. Apart from cutting between the small number of sets, it feels quite like a play, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. It does.
Which is not a negative. It's just a different approach.
Exactly. But, yeah, the sets inside the lighthouse were excellent. But you also mentioned earlier the rocky set, you know, outside, which is excellent. You said
you thought
it was a location, didn't you?
Yeah, I can't say anything suggests it isn't, even looking at it now. Mm. That's really done well, yeah.
Yeah, so fairly positive on the set, sir.
Oh, yeah. On to direction. Unspectacular, I would say. I mean, it's nothing that jumps out as a piece of, you know, innovative direction or anything, but it just works well, and it's edited well for pace, isn't it? There's some nice point-of-view shots from the Rutan, as we've said.
Mm.
That's probably about as complicated as the direction gets, but...
I thought they could have tightened up the first couple of episode endings. Just needed a little bit of tightening up.
On the edit, yeah, you're right.
On the edit.
That's true.
But other than that, I don't think there's no, like you say, it's kind of unspectacular but good.
Yeah, effective, basically.
Effective, yeah.
So Dudley Simpson back on incidental music.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the sound of his era, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Until Tom Baker's last season, really. I thought, you know, he was standard Dudley Simpson of that era, and that's not to denigrate it. It's got that great Hinchcliffe sound, isn't it?
It has.
Even though it carries on beyond Hinchcliffe, but I mean, it's unobtrusive. But there is a bit I noticed which was really good, and that was when the Doctor and Leela are searching among the rocks for the alien. There's some really quiet, sort of urgent music from Dudley Simpson there, which I thought was really, really effective.
Mm. Okay, so generally pretty positive stuff then, I would say.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Shall we have a little bit of talk about the audits for these episodes?
Yeah, I love this bit.
I know. I love it equally, which is not very much. So, part one, 6.8 million viewers. The cricket Gillette Cup finals on BBC Two at this point. Part two, 7.1 million viewers. And then a huge leap for part three, 9.8 million. Part four, 9.9 million, which is the kind of audience you expected at this stage in Doctor Who, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty strong.
Pretty high. So I think the other stuff, and this is the first story of the season. Maybe people hadn't twigged it was back on again. But there's a huge jump from part two to part three, and I think that's just people getting on board, isn't it?
I think it's just whoever puts the stats together just inverting the number by mistake.
Well, maybe. Which invalidates the entire point of talking about these things.
Well, we have this argument every time, but you know,
We do. There's one
fascinating.
thing, it is fascinating, incredibly fascinating. There was one thing I wanted to say actually about the basic plot here. We know the story of this. We mentioned the Time Warrior podcast that Terence Dick, script editor for John Pertwee's era, wanted Robert Holmes to write a story about medieval Earth. And Robert Holmes, of course, is now script editor at this point, and he asked Terence Dicks to write a story, and he put it on a turn of the century lighthouse. As it happens, the plots aren't massively dissimilar, are they? Because you've got a crashed participant of the Sontaran-Rutan War landing on Earth in the past, and although the Sontaran was just basically trying to get back to the fight, the Rutan is trying to make a bit more of what he's found, isn't he? Trying to make Earth as a base to take on the Centaurans, but the starting point at least is very similar between the two stories. I don't know if that's by design or by luck. But
Well, he probably just nicked the idea from him, didn't he?
to pay Robert Holmes back.
But the end
But I
result
like
is excellent, so
it is, yeah.
the one thing I thought there was a hole in the story isn't a hole, as we discussed earlier, which was the bit about the Rutan going up the outside of the lighthouse. So, yeah, I can't really see any many holes in it at all. It's very strong. It's really enjoyable to watch.
It is, yeah, definitely. Because of the way they've placed it in time, I like the kind of distrust and the lack of understanding of electricity they've got. And of course, the Rutan understands it completely, and so does the Doctor, but no one else does, including the Doctor's companion on this one, because Leela doesn't understand electricity either. Not that that's integral to the plot, but it's interesting that it's the Rutan and the Doctor understand and no one else does. So that's great. As I say, the only thing I would say is that scene where the Doctor finally meets the Rutan, and although the mocking is quite amusing, and certainly as a kid I thought it was funny when he took the mick out of the aliens, I think it does remove attention. But that is the only thing that I can think of that's a problem.
Yeah, and as I've said, I didn't see it as a problem really. What do you think? Should we rate it?
I think we should.
Okay, I'll go first this time if you like. I think I'll give it 9 out of 10. I think it's cracking, to be honest. Cracking story. You know, it's up there with Tom Baker's best. I've never rated it that highly before, actually. I've always kind of liked it, but I've never really loved it. But watching it again this time round, a couple of times, I can't see anything not to like about it, really. It's scary. You know, you got the two leads at the top of their game, I think. Atmospheric. It's just a wonderful story.
Yeah, it's great. I'm going for a 9 out of 10 as well. I'm only dropping that point because of a scene I didn't like with the Doctor and the Rutan meeting. It's what Doctor Who does best, I think. Base Under Siege, although it's been used a lot, is one of the best plot devices for Doctor Who, isn't it? And it's also one of the things that BBC does best, which is costume drama. To have those together and with that kind of Pygmalion thing in the background, as I've said, with the Doctor and Leela, and some well-realized characters, they're all pretty 3D, aren't they, the characters? It's, they're all quite rounded, aren't they?
Yeah, they are definitely. Especially Reuben, he's quite rounded.
Yeah, he's got the roundest belly of the lot. And it's interesting that this extra bit, you needed something probably, but it's great that they brought this political stroke commerce sort of wrangle into it as well. It drives the narrative. It's not there just for a bit of fluff, is it?
No.
Padding. It causes people's deaths.
Exactly.
And it's one of those things, it's Doctor Who as a moral guide, isn't it? Telling its young audience not to do these naughty things that people do and end up getting killed for. It shows humankind at its best and at its worst, doesn't it?
Yeah, cracking stuff.
Okay, just one bit of feedback this time. I think we've probably taken you a little bit by surprise without announcing when we were going to actually do this through domestic factors with me and Martin. This is the only time we could do it and do it left enough time to give you any warning. But thanks to Jeff Waddle for giving us some feedback. He says, of course, famously, the only story where all but the regulars die, which I hadn't thought about that. That is literally the only story where the Doctor and his companion are the only ones that live at the end. Tom Baker is at the height of his powers here. A creepy story, a glowing ping pong ball with attached silly string, a matchstick boat. Great stuff. Well, Jeff's obviously not put off by the shortfalls in the special effects department. But I mean, he's right. It is a great story, despite that, really. But because Tom Baker's at the height of his powers and it's a creepy story, it's interesting to have a story where they all die except for the cast. It happens in Resurrection of the Daleks, doesn't it? And maybe Warriors of the Deep, but it doesn't happen that often because there's normally someone to thank them at the end, isn't there?
Resurrection? I don't know, we'll find out next time, won't we?
We will, because that's the next story, listeners.
Seamless, isn't it, this?
Yeah, we don't chuck this stuff together,
Well, we do, but don't tell anybody.
Thanks, Jeff. As we've just revealed, the next story is going to be Peter Davison's Resurrection of the Daleks.
Hurrah!
Available in super refurbished styly on the Revisitations 2 box set, from which we've already taken Seeds of Death. So if our choice of podcast has any bearing on how you spend your money, then you could snap up Seeds of Death and Resurrection of the Daleks and Carnival of Monsters, Pertwee Era, which we will probably cover at some point in the future, all for the price of whatever the price is.
Oh, that's cheaper than that, surely.
Yeah, it depends what the price is.
Anyway, moving swiftly on.
From that unresearched bit of merchandise.
Okay, so Resurrection of the Daleks next, where we'll find out the answer to whether or not everybody dies.
So thanks very much for listening. I should point out the usual ways to get in contact with us. You can contact us direct by email at crinoid@mail.com. You can go to our blog site at crinoid.blog.co.uk. You can have a look at the top left-hand menu on that blog site to find an instant link to our Facebook area. And you can also tweet us or follow us at Crinoid on Twitter.
Good stuff.
We'd like to hear what you think about Resurrection of the Daleks, or if anyone did have anything they want to say about Horror Fang Rock, but were cruelly denied that opportunity. Email us and we'll get it into the next podcast, which will be on Resurrection of the Daleks. So thanks very much for listening to this one, and we hope you listen to the next one. So it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me. See you next time.
Either we hunted high and low, and hunted everywhere, the three men's fate, we found no trace. In any time, in any place.
But a door ajar and an untouched meal and an overtoppled chair. Thank you.